and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Brothers, sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Pennsylvania State Senator Dalen Leach may be talking about the school voucher stuff after a comment last night by Republican State Senator Mike Fulmer. One of these things that you got to follow up on. So this idea that the voucher, this lottery ticket, this school lottery ticket is somehow going to be a ticket for a child to go to any school he or she chooses, just absolutely wrong. And we're going to talk a little bit about that with the good senator. Also, Russ Baker, award-winning investigative reporter and the author of the book Family of Secrets, as well as founder of WhoWhatWhy.com, is going to be here talking about what's going on in Egypt. And, you know, big news, if it is what we're being told, Mubarak will be leaving. They're now planning for how to do that, have the vice president there take over. So that should be an interesting discussion. And as we're watching the news break right now, and also Dr. Steven Herzenberg, executive director of the Keystone Research Center, going to be talking about the report they're going to release tomorrow on jobs in Pennsylvania and the future of our economy. So that should be interesting, as well as your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, in watching what's going on over in Egypt, I got to be honest, I am absolutely in awe of these people and the courage that they're showing. You sometimes you're in these mob scenes, and I can't say that I've ever been in anything like that, but I've been in some hairy situations where, to be honest, you want to flee. But these people, they're standing their ground. Their vision is a better tomorrow. And, you know, for all the spin that's been going on around this, and everybody's trying to figure out how to spin this, and to be honest, you know, when I look at a scenario like this, I don't know Egypt. I don't know all of the undercurrents. I don't know all of the factions. But at the end of the day, when you're looking at a dictator like Mubarak, you're looking at another one of these situations where the mass of the people are neglected for the handful at the very top. And you wonder, why has it taken so long for people to rise up and fight back and look for a better future? You know, it's kind of interesting because I was reading a piece just a week or two ago that what they were saying is because of Twitter and Facebook and all of these social networking sites that we were going to see the young people in this world rise up and well, in this very libertarian way, take over. And, you know, at the time you go, well, you know, maybe that's going to happen at some point in the future. The future's now. And you look at what's going on there. The first thing the country did was try to shut off the internet, shut off their communications. And I go back to what we're talking about here in this country, the Joe Liebermans of the world saying, oh, we need the internet kill switch. Why? you know, look over there. Look what happened. They have the internet kill switch. And, you know, I got to be honest with you. This is more of that, you know, I'm not being conspiratorial. I'm being, look what happened. And think about what could happen here if you saw 2%. Because that's all you got out in the streets there in Egypt. 2% of the people. 2 out of every 100 people are in the street. If you had 2 out of every 100 people taking to the streets here, demanding better health care, demanding better employment, demanding better schools, better roads, better bridges, demanding a better life, this globe would come to a complete stop. It would come to a complete stop.
If you have any questions about why the people are, you know, they've had it, I just heard a figure tonight, and I was staggered by it, Rick. 25% of the Egyptian people live on less than $2 a day. $2 a day. There was also a very telling comment.
You just heard that today?
Yeah, actually.
Okay. Actually.
I mean, that's, to me, is staggering. There was a very telling comment by a foreign policy expert, in which he said was, even the middle class, and you said it's kind of a middle up. Obviously, the poor are involved in it. You know, it was just expressed by the figures I gave. But even the middle class who are able to go to college, those young people are coming out of college and saying, look, I might have a college education, but there's no future. They saw their fathers, they saw their fathers live in desperation. Yep. No job, no future, very little freedom. And they say, no, I'm not, I need better. I want better. I want what any normal human being wants. I want a little freedom. I want the right to a decent job and take care of my family. And I want a future for my children.
And, you know, and this is where I'm going to be called, well, you're blaming America. You look at Wall Street, and a lot of this can be tied right back to the speculators on Wall Street, to these big hedge fund managers who now look at food, look at wheat and grain and all this stuff as a commodity, to be traded 7, 10, 100 times. And just like oil, you remember when oil prices were $100 a barrel, it was $4 a gallon, things were just getting out of hand, and Congress stepped in and put a stop to the mass trading of oil as a commodity as it came into the U.S. Because they showed a ship full of oil, a tanker full of oil coming here, was bought and sold and traded back and forth at least 27 times. That means there are 27 hands out taking bits and taking bits. And, yeah, OPEC had the price through the roof. But even before it got here, the price was jacked up by $1 a gallon just by pure speculation. And this, you know, on $2 a day, when the price of wheat goes up $1 a bushel and the price of food goes up even in the smallest amounts, you have mass suffering. And that's what this is. The middle class, you know, not really, look, there's not a middle class like we think of it, as I understand. But, you know, the people who aren't the poverty folks, the people just above that who were getting by, these are the folks, as I understand it, are the ones that are ticked off because they're not being able to feed their family. You know, it's much like the Tea Party thing. And I hearken back to that. Because you had these people who were angry, the people that I met. Now, I've had some people tell me, well, you know, I think you've got it wrong. But the folks that I met who went to these rallies were folks who had been told, you work for a company 30 years, you'll have $1 million in your 401k, you work hard, you play by the rules, everything will be fine. And they did that. And they looked at their 401k, and it was not $1 million. They looked into the future, and they saw, how am I going to I'm never going to be able to retire. They looked into the future and said, my kids are struggling. They're not leaving the house because they can't find jobs. And they were angry. And I was right there because I'm right there with you. But I look at this situation in Egypt and I say, you know, good for these folks. Good for them. And we should be doing what we can do to help them from outside. And as I understand, the president and the administration is brokering a deal to get Mubarak out. The vice president will take over on an interim basis, as I understand, until September when they will have an election. And they're talking about, you know, until then, how are they going to bring in all the opposition groups? How are they going to bring in all the different factions, including the banned Muslim Brotherhood? That's going to be an interesting undertaking. The Vice President Omar Suleiman, I guess it is. He's going to be the new president under this new breaking story by the New York Times. We'll see how that goes forward. Things may change by morning, but right now, Mubarak evidently going to be out, and he should be. It's time, and good riddance. But anyway, today on the program, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. If you've got ideas, I would love to hear it. If you were there, you know people there, we'd love to hear that as well. But Russ Baker is going to come and talk to us about what his thoughts are, and I look forward to that. Because, you know, Jake, look at this scenario. You know, this isn't in our news. We see little clips on TV, and I watched some of this on TV last night, and all they showed were the explosions and the Molotov cocktails and the gunshots. I wanted to hear the people's stories. We hear, Brian Williams, someone threatened Brian Williams. Big headlines. I'd threaten Brian Williams. Someone punched Anderson Cooper. Well, I wish someone would have punched him a long time ago.
I mean, the truth is they are going after the media over there, the international press, and there was a spokesman for one of the local newspapers, and they said, our office has been trashed.
Well, the people who are supporting Mubarak, of course.
Absolutely.
Because you don't want this. And you don't want this to get out.
That
you don't want peaceful protests to get out.
To me, was very disconcerting because on the one hand, the army had separated the two groups, but they really didn't do a lot about protecting the media.
I mean, the right is really having a problem in this country, because on one hand, they really want to embrace this as a validation of the Bush policies, a validation of the Bush doctrine. You know, when we took Iraq down, democracy would spread like wildfire. You know, that's what they really bought that, and they really want to do it. But they also want that fear and smear. Oh, the Muslim Brotherhood, they're going to take over.
Well, did you hear the latest? They had a spokesman on false news today. And he's claiming that, our government is actually taking instruction from the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I don't know where they got that.
See, because Obama he's the Manchurian candidate.
That's
and
correct.
He's a Muslim. He's one of them.
But if you want,
in fact, he started this.
Any credibility at all, it just defies logic. But I have to say, an Argo, when I left, it hadn't broke on the national news that I was watching. So that's great. That is great. You know, to my estimation, Rick, I thought the best scenario would be the military forces him out, and within a short time you set up a structure where you can have free and independent elections, and it looks like at least in general terms, that's exactly what happened. Now, I would prefer if it was quicker than September, but if, in fact, they go through with the process and they have free and open elections, that's about, under these circumstances, that's about the best scenario you can expect.
I don't know the protesters leave without getting Mubarak out. I don't know that this ends
Well, what's the timeline here, Rick?
I don't know that they disperse. I don't know that anything stops until he's out. So this putting his vice president in seems to me to be the right step to defusing more violence. Because 5 dead, nearly 1,000 injured at this point. To me, it's time to defuse. It's time for him to go. And we'll see what happens from here. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Senator Dalen Leach, we're going to be talking about the voucher situation. Like I said last night, this idea that this golden ticket is going to solve all our problems seems to be a little nonsensical.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. During the blizzard and ice storms that are creating havoc across the country, it's off International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers linemen who are on the front lines making sure that your power stays on, or restoring it when Mother Nature takes it out. But in Washington, D.C., IBEW Local 1900's John Holt says that an aging infrastructure and a reliance on contractors rather than highly trained full-time employees makes it increasingly difficult to mount an effective response during weather emergencies. He says in D.C. and around the nation, one thing is needed more than anything else to make sure our power grid is well maintained.
If Public Service Commission would require the companies to hire full-time employees to be able to maintain the system, build the system, maintain the system, and in turn respond in emergency situations. That is ideal, and that's the way it was originally set up, but it's just not working the same way. We really need more boots on the ground that are experienced and that are full-time employees.
The heavy winter storms have forced at least 33 U.S. auto factories to shut down temporarily. 26 of those were Ford and Chrysler plants. Parts shortages caused by the stormy weather forced the shutdowns of at least one shift at the plants on Wednesday. U.S. auto parts supplier facilities are concentrated in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and those states were hit hard by the blizzard and by ice storms. California's governor is calling on the people of the state to approve a proposition raising taxes to get more revenue for schools. Jesse Russell reports.
In his State of the State address on Monday night, California Governor Jerry Brown acknowledged that education has been one of the hardest hit over the last few years when it comes to making cuts to balancing the budget. During the last 3 years, California schools and colleges have been hit with $18 billion in cuts. It is now up to California voters to approve an extension of taxes under Proposition 98, or education could lose an additional $2 billion. Brown called for approval of the proposition during his speech, and during a conference call on Tuesday, California School Employees Association legislative advocate Steve Henderson echoed the importance of preserving the extension.
For a state that has the highest standards, the highest educational standards in the nation, for us to only be funding our educational program at 56 cents on the dollar, there's something wrong with that.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, back to a man who's never seen a $20,000 shower curtain, Rick Smith.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy, it hurts. And I am too sexy for Milan. Too sexy for Milan.
Yeah. That only means one thing. The I'm Too Sexy song only means one thing. Our good friend, Pennsylvania State Senator Dalen Leach. Senator, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Rick. Whenever I hear that song, I think of you.
All right. You know, in the inauguration of our newly elected governor, he said, quote, our education system must contend with other nations, and so we must embrace innovation, competition, and choice in our education system. And everybody is all up in arms on both sides. The right's thrilled to death that they're going to finally get their ideological lottery ticket here. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, first of all, people have to understand what this proposal is. The Senate Bill 1, which is the bill which would establish vouchers in Pennsylvania, is a huge new government entitlement. So first of all, you'd be surprised that the folks on the right would be interested in that. It entitles a wide group of people to a check from the state to go to private school. And it sort of violates every tenet of conservatism, but they don't like public schools, so it's, you know, that sort of trumps the usual principles. If I can just walk through a couple of the problems with this. First of all, every student under this bill who qualifies is eligible for approximately $9,000 voucher, which they can use at another public school or private school. We'll talk about that in a second. But the first obvious question is, where does that money come from? Now, they will tell you the money comes from it follows the child. It, rather than going to the public school, it would go with the child to the new private school or the other public school that they go to. The problem, of course, is that if a child stops going to a public school, that public school does not save $9,000.
Right.
You can't get rid of a teacher. Most of the costs of public education are fixed. You have to still heat the building. You have to hire a nurse. All the things you have to do, you still have to do. So what happens is you have a poor school district which is struggling because it doesn't have enough resources, which suddenly has even fewer resources per child as a result of this. Now, this is really important because at the end of the day, very few children are actually going to be able to go to other schools because of these vouchers. Keep in mind, the voucher says two things. You can go to another public school or another or a private school. However, let's take private schools first. Most private schools charge far more than the $9,000 voucher. So if you want to, for example, go to Shipley, which is a private school in my area, that's $25,000 a year. So when they say, well, you should have a choice of what school to go to, if you show up at Shipley with a $9,000 voucher, they're going to say that's wonderful, assuming they want to take you. And, of course, they don't have to take anybody. But assuming they did, they'd say that's very nice. Where is your additional, you know, $16,000? Now, if you're living at 130% of the poverty rate, which is what this statute says, you're not going to have that $16,000. So you're not going to be going to Shipley.
Right. So hold on. Let me stop here for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Because last night I talked to State Senator Mike Fulmer. And, you know, Mike, pretty, you know, very candidly, well, let me play you the clip. We were talking about just what you're talking about here, the fact that kids would want to go into a place like Abington Friends School with their voucher. And here's what transpired last night. They were able to do is they were able to pick and choose the kids who were going to do just
fine. No. See, that's one of the myths about the SB1. We're not, they can't pick it. They're going to get a voucher. They can't pick and choose.
So he's saying that SB1 is explicit that if a school is going to take the voucher, any voucher, they have to take all of the vouchers. So if 100,000 kids want to go to Abington Friends School down in your way, 100,000 kids can go because they all have these lottery tickets and the school has to take them.
Well, first of all, Mike's a very nice guy, but he hasn't read the bill. The bill, first of all, it divides private and public school. Private schools do not have to take anyone they don't want to take. They don't even have to participate in the voucher program at all. They don't have to honor these vouchers. And if they do, the statute says specifically, they can set the criteria by which they admit students. If they have tough academic standards or performance standards, they don't have to compromise those. They're going to take the kids they want to take. And, you know, forgetting for a moment that these kids still have to pay the full tuition. So Mike is just wrong about that. On public schools, it is a little strange. What the statute says is the public school, A, can set their own criteria. B, can decide if they want to participate in vouchers at all. You don't have to do it if you're a public school either. But if you participate in vouchers, you have to accept the kids on a first-come, first-served basis, which is inconsistent with the part of the statute that says you can set your own criteria. However, let's think about this. Again, let's take a school in my school district, Lower Marion. It costs about $22,000 per child to educate a child in Lower Marion.
Wow.
Now, suddenly, they're going to have a bunch of kids from outside of Lower Marion with a $9,000 voucher saying, I want an education. What do you think the taxpayers of Lower Marion are going to say? They're like, hey, wait a minute. We voted to raise taxes on ourselves to pay more money so we could educate our kids in a better situation. Now we're going to be subsidizing all these other kids who want to come to Lower Marion. That's just not going to happen. And there's no space for these kids anyway. I mean, maybe one or two or three as a token effort. But, you know, if 300 kids show up at Lower Marion High School with vouchers from Philadelphia or from any other school district, there's going to be like, sorry, you know, A, where's the rest of your money? B, we're not taking that many kids. You're just not going to be able to go to Lower Marion. There's another limitation. The statute says that the school district only has to provide transportation if you're 10 miles away.
Right.
Okay? Which means that, you know, since poverty is concentrated, many school districts aren't even going to have a viable option unless the parents somehow want to get their kids, you know, to these schools on their own, which, again, if they're living in poverty, you would think that would be very difficult for them to do. So what we've seen in other cities that this has been tried in is that, in reality, very few kids are able to take advantage of it. The statement, my child, my choice, is a false statement, an empty promise providing false hope to people that they're going to just be able to walk into any school they want, regardless of their child's academic achievements, regardless of how much money they have, and demand that school educate their child. That is simply not going to happen.
You know, last night when we talked with Mike Fulmer, he said that this was the this generation's great equalizer. It was going to be the thing that desegregated our schools. And, you know, my response was, you know, I think economics is what's caused our segregation. All the people in poverty live in one area. We should be, you know, moving the resources around. Where I grew up in Cleveland, they did this silly thing when I was a kid called busing, where they took poor kids from one side of the city of Cleveland, put them on buses and shipped them 2 hours to the other side of the city of Cleveland to another poor area. Didn't accomplish much, but it burnt up an awful lot of resources, and the school district's still paying the bill. And I look at this voucher thing, as really the next genesis of something as ignorant as busing.
Yeah, I mean, this is not an equalizer. This is the opposite. This is, the public schools are the civil right here. A free, appropriate public education is what we're all supposed to be entitled to. If you want something else, obviously you're free to pay for it. But what's going to happen here is that there's going to be very little room, and some of the elite private schools will take one, two, or three kids, give them some financial aid. You know, the best kids from each school, the most promising, the rest of the kids will be left behind in a school that we as a state are essentially incrementally abandoning because we are taking away resources from that school, which is already suffering from a lack of resources. You're going to have even poorer schools providing even poorer educations for 95% of the kids who are going to be forced to stay at those schools. That is a horrible, talk about no child left behind. This is leaving the overwhelming majority of poor kids behind, the way it's written in Senate Bill 1.
Let me ask you this, Senator Leach, because I had this conversation yesterday with somebody who I consider a friend, who kind of shocked me. By saying that, you know, this voucher thing was only for those people in places like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. They wouldn't come to an area like Carlisle or Mechanicsburg or Shippensburg. It was only, and the phrase those people stuck in my mind. I'm curious what your thoughts on a statement like that are.
You mean those people referring to?
Those people like in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
Oh, you mean like a racial issue or whatever?
That's how I took it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even, keep in mind, the majority of people, of poor people in Pennsylvania are white, people. This isn't a racial issue. This is an issue of kids in poverty, the resources that are being, the few resources we give to kids in poverty to get educated being taken away from them to give to elite private schools, where they want this bill to go is every kid's eligible for a voucher, which means kids who are already sending their kids to let's say Shipley are just going to get a check in the mail.
Nice windfall.
Yeah.
No, but the reason I bring it up is there's this thought, I think, that the vouchers are only going to affect places like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, that it's not going to harm our schools here, and there's nothing going to happen here.
Oh no, it's going to be bad. Well, first of all, let's take an elite school district like Lower Marion. Okay, this is how it could hurt even an elite school district like Lower Marion. Right now, Lower Marion has one of the best schools in the state, but there's a lot of affluent people in Lower Marion, so a good percentage of people, I don't know the exact percentage, let's say it's 20%, 25%, already send their kids to private school, okay?
Right.
Whether it's Shipley or Baldwin or Haverford or one, there's many private schools in the Lower Marion area. If what they would like to see comes to full fruition, all of those parents, many of whom don't need the money, will suddenly get big checks, $9,000 per kid per year, to send their kids to Baldwin, which they're already doing. So this changes outcomes for zero children. The outcome is exactly the same. It's just that we're giving people who are affluent checks, okay? And where is that money coming from? It's coming from Lower Marion School District. Even an elite school like Lower Marion is going to see its resources depleted over time if this vouchers thing comes to fruition. So this can hurt every public school district, but it will hurt the poorest public school districts first.
Right. Let me ask you this then, because Senator Tony Williams seems to be all in favor of this. You know, he ran for governor on the school choice platform, the lottery winning people gave him a lot of money to get the message out there. Why do you think he's going after this if what you're saying is true? And then I guess the other side of this is, how do we make the schools that are not doing well do better?
Two great questions. I mean, first of all, I assume Tony's going after this because he really believes it. I just happen to think he's wrong on it. However, you ask a great question, which is, what do we do to make things better? We have seen the results of investing resources into public schools. Our math scores, since Rendell started doing that 8 years ago, have doubled. We have been named as the most improved state in public education in the nation. And so it's not a difficult formula. You know, they say throwing money at a problem doesn't solve it, but depriving a school of resources certainly hurts. You know, if kids aren't getting textbooks, if kids aren't getting computers, if kids are in classes of 40 kids rather than 20 kids or 25 kids, that's going to hurt. So let's make sure that every public school has the resources it needs, and then let's hold people accountable. If there are teachers, if there are principals who are not performing, let's find out why and let's deal with that. I'm all for that. I'm all for accountability, which is another issue. I mean, keep in mind, with these vouchers going to private schools have no accountability. They don't have to test. They don't take the PSSAs, number one. They don't have to comply with federal laws like IDEA or No Child Left Behind. They don't have to do anything. They have no accountability at all except to the parents who are paying the tuition. So, if, you know, the question is, now that they're going to be getting state money if this were to pass, do they get more accountability? I don't think they want additional accountability. I think if you put a lot more accountability on them, they're not going to participate, which they're free not to do. And if you do put a lot more if you don't put a lot more accountability on them, then we're putting state money into something we don't even know what the outcome is.
Yeah, and with our budget hole, this massive budget hole that we're facing, and the cuts and the no tax pledge and all of this stuff rolling in the ball, I got to wonder if this is the right time for this. But I got to be honest, I hear Senator Pileggi running around saying the opposite of what you're saying about money in schools and how the Rendell years didn't improve anything.
Well, that's just not true. I mean, empirically, I don't know what measure he's looking at. I mean, the fact is that scores are up, organizations around the country, nonpartisan organizations, are recognizing our efforts. So I don't know how he could say that nothing good has happened as a result of that. But again, if he supports this, let's hear the answer to these questions. Where does the money come from? Are the schools held harmless? Because, you know, I'm arguing they're not. And I think the empirical data will show that they're not. So what happens to the kids left behind? How many private schools are going to be taking how many kids? How many public schools are going to be taking how many kids? And who's going to make up the difference in the cost between the voucher and the actual cost of education at these more elite institutions?
Right.
These are questions that have not been answered. And before we take a huge step like this, need to be answered.
Have the Democrats come up with a proposal to make education better based? I mean, I think we're going in the right direction, but to something competing with SB1?
Well, not specifically. I mean, I think the approach we've used for the last 8 years has been a good approach and has shown results. To the extent that we can, you know, look at things like more magnet schools and more schools for the arts and more resources for schools in struggling neighborhoods. That's what the funding formula was supposed to be about, which you remember we passed a few years ago.
Right.
To the extent we can look at that, I am all for that. And I've voted for that. Let's really make a commitment to fully fund the funding formula and get the best schools in every neighborhood. That's what we should be doing. But just giving a voucher to unaccountable private schools who choose to accept the students they want to accept, reject everyone else, and abandon the rest of those kids in an increasingly starved public school is not the approach I think that's appropriate.
I agree. Last question I've got for you. You know, one of the things that we heard during the last election was we need smaller government, we need less bureaucracy. Yet I look at this bill, or from what I've seen of it, it creates a whole nother layer of bureaucracy from what I understand. This bureaucracy decides who gets their lottery ticket or lottery voucher punched and who's basically standing there with better luck next time stamped on it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is, as I said, coming full circle, a huge new government entitlement, a huge new government program of undetermined cost, because we don't know how many kids are actually going to be accepted to any of these schools, but, you know, with a potentially huge cost, hundreds of millions of dollars per year. Where is that money going to come from in the context of a $4 to $5 billion deficit? No one's answered these questions. This is more an ideological thought than it is a thought-out piece of legislation.
Yeah, I agree. Senator Leach, I appreciate your time. I'd love to have you back again real soon.
Anytime. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Media tycoon Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal last year, and in short order, he has turned it into a tongue-clucking sympathizer with and proselytizer for the biggest of big businesses, not only on its editorial pages, but also in its news stories. For example, a recent report on the economic trouble of America's financial giants was so saccharinely sympathetic to the bankers that you could practically see teardrops on the page. The opening paragraph wailed that the banking industry is, quote, racked by the financial crisis and facing slower revenue growth. Nowhere in the story was there even an allusion to the crucial fact that the racking was brought upon the poor bankers, not to mention the rest of us, by, guess who, the bankers themselves. Instead, the Journal wrote admiringly of Wells Fargo, American Express, State Street, and other powerhouses of finance that are nobly struggling, quote, in challenging economic conditions to cut costs and become more efficient. Would this admirable drive for efficiency include any sacrifices in salary, perks, and bonuses of the absurdly pampered top bankers? Holy Gordon Gecko, get real! No, no, sacrifices for others. As the title of the Journal's article puts it, lenders see little choice, layoffs. And Murdoch's Wall Street Journal is not about to be so rude as to mention that if his banker chums really want to become leaner, they could start by looking in the mirror. Indeed, in deference to the tender sensibilities of Wall Street, the Journal doesn't even refer to the offing of thousands of bank workers as firings. Rather, these people are soullessly termed headcount reductions. This is Jim Hightower saying, in word and in tone, Rupert Murdoch is boiling the journalism out of the once proud news pages of the Journal, reducing the paper's proper name to Wall Street's Journal.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.com.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, yeah, I mean, this is the sound we're going to be hearing across the state. If the Republicans ever get their act together, they're going to hire an auctioneer and off go the state liquor stores, off go the highways, off go the turnpike, off go the schools, you know, fire sale prices. We got a lot to look forward to fight. We got a lot to fight back on. Let's go to the phone lines. Got James on line one. How are we doing tonight, James?
Pretty good. Been a while.
Yeah, I missed you.
All right, I like the senator's responses, but there's one thing. Now, I'll also admit I'm a little out of the loop on this. But one thing I think you also need to look at is that if you're going to fix schools, and this could be a chicken-egg argument, you also got to work on the communities those schools are in. I mean, I look at the place I grew up.
Yep.
Rust Belt, small town, not a lot of economic infrastructure. I mean, are schools the cause or the effect or a little of both? And I mean, I don't see enough from either side of the aisle on that.
Well, at the end of the nobody's really talking about the bigger problems, which is what you're getting at, the socioeconomics. The fact that you've got struggling parents at home, maybe one parent at home who's working two jobs or, you know, whatever the home life is, or maybe you're just not getting somebody who's kicking the kids in the behind to doing the work. You've got to deal with that component of it. And I would argue, having grown up where I did as a young man in a housing project, I saw a lot of parents who didn't didn't value education and didn't push their children.
Okay, I'll see you on that because, I mean, as I said, as this gets further and further along, I will probably be doing some sort of one of my many little articles I know I haven't done for a while.
Well, this would be a good topic because, you know, look, at the end of this, there's while this voucher thing I think is a bad idea, there's got to be a good idea out there, and there's got to be a way to bring up the failing schools.
And I'm going to tell you right now what I think it would be.
Okay, tell me.
And I don't know, and this is going to sound crazy. Eliminate local funding. Make it so that schools are not funded by local property taxes or anything, that they're funded more out of a common pool.
Well, here's the problem with that. You heard the senator say that his area, Lower Merion, they pay $22,000 per student into the school. You want to hear people cry? You want to hear rich people cry?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a bunch of rich people crying. And a lot of school districts would be doing that. But I agree with you. I do think, and I've said this for the longest time, we should break down the number of school districts. There are 500 school districts in a state with only 67 counties.
Okay, I don't mean to ramble, but I grew up in western Pennsylvania. And it was always rather weird, especially around Pittsburgh, is that you would see these big school districts that would be made up of four or five probably fairly affluent communities. And then you'd have one smaller school district that would basically be a more minority community.
Well, that's by design, James.
I always found it weird, and then, you know, I started figuring it out.
Which is why when I was a kid, the courts tried to even out the number of white and black kids in classrooms by doing this insane thing called busing. But what busing ended up doing is you would go from one side of town to the other side of town, and you'd still be in the same poverty environment. So
I just wanted to speak up on it, and I just wanted to
appreciate it.
Bring that in.
Thanks so much, James.
Alrighty, bye bye.
Look, at the end of this, I go back to my days as a young man, seeing my friends get on buses, because they weren't fortunate like I was. And, you know, this is kind of where I'm at. My mother cleaned the church. My mother did a whole bunch of work, to get me into Catholic school. Every child didn't have that opportunity, and I understand the voucher idea. I do. I understand the lottery ticket that's going to get my kid into this school. I get that. But this is not the way to go about it. This is not it at all. And it's not, you know, putting people on buses, going back to that either.
Well, one thing James mentioned, in fact, I was going to talk about it even before he mentioned it, has been proposed before, statewide funding, but that would create a firestorm. I do believe, I heard the ex-governor, I think the governor knew that he could get it passed. I don't think the former Democratic governor would have had a problem with that, although you're exactly right. The wealthier school districts would be howling on that. Well, here's another proposal.
Well, I mean, at the end of it.
How about county? How about what they do in Maryland? County schools? One school district within the county? That might be a partial way to do it. I think you might have some problems doing that in other areas, but as far as funding, it might help a little bit. But I wouldn't have a problem with funding at the state level, but you're going to have an awful difficult time getting that passed through the legislature.
Well, of course you would. But the reality is we've got 500 schools districts. That means 500 superintendents. That means all of the higher-up bureaucracy that isn't in the classroom. So you think of all that wasted resource. That's where you start cutting. That's what you start going after. At least that's my opinion.
Well,
then you get into maybe looking at pooling some more resources and maybe not taking from Lower Merion, maybe adding a little extra to the places that need it. Because I don't think you're going to get the one big pot. While that be ideal, it's not going to happen. See, I wouldn't mind the one big pot because places like Lower Merion would say, well, we want more. So we want our kids to have better education. We've got the resources. So they'd kick in a little bit more. I can see that happening, but I just don't see politically, especially now that you've got these ideologues running things. And this really is, at the end of it, their dream of profit. I mean, call it what it is. This is privatization. This is selling off another state asset. This is making a buck where there wasn't one before. And we hear, and I've heard Pelleggi talk a number of times on this, about, you know, getting the entrepreneurial spirit into education, getting schools to compete. Yeah, that's all fine, well, and good. But as the senator said a moment ago, most of the costs are fixed. You still have to pay for the building. You still have to heat it. You still have to take care of it. You have to maintain it. You still have the principal. You still have the teachers. All these costs are fixed. It's not like that $9,000 that is going to leave the school district is somehow saved by that kid leaving. That's not it at all. So unless we can come up with a better funding mechanism, and look, I'm not against, you know, I'm not against having school specialized schools, but I'm against having for-profit public schools. It doesn't make any sense to me on any level.
And then at the end of the day, as we said before, the proof is in the pudding. There's really not evidence that these private schools perform any better.
And even with the fact that they do get to pick and choose. Right now, they are picking and choosing the kids that they want, the best and the brightest, the ones whose parents are taking the initiative to get them into them, into these schools. So if you've got parents who are going to take the time and the initiative to get you into this school, I think you got a shot no matter where the kid goes, because you've got active, engaged parents.
Well,
and that's what I want for every kid, not a voucher. I want active, engaged parents. I want to figure out how we help all parents move along.
Well, here's another thing we haven't even talked about. Do you think they're going to take a kid that has dyslexia or learning about disabilities?
That's the other thing this
probably
bill
not.
This bill
probably
does not mandate, so you're, mandate at all.
There's another group you're going to leave behind.
Well, of course. This is the class structure. This is the separating. This is more of us and them. This is the haves and the have-nots. Education, like health care, is going to be another one of those defining moments. Are you in the middle class? Can you afford health care? Can you afford education? Or are you not? It's going to be a have and have-not thing.
And what we're forgetting, the reason that public schools are mandated is because the idea way back, the idea was there's only a select few in our society that got it. And to mandate that every child has that opportunity, there had to be mandates. Whether you have ADD or whether you have a learning disability, the public schools had to take you. And there's logical reasons. You're exactly right. What we're really going to do, we're going to go back to the future, unfortunately.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go right there and download our podcast. I want to thank all of our podcast listeners. Remember, you can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We do appreciate your input. You know, going back to this, just to kind of wrap this up, there's this right-wing drumbeat. That, you know, throwing money at a problem doesn't solve the problem. Throwing money at the problem doesn't solve the problem. Well, I don't know many problems that putting resources into can't solve. You know, it's better to have more than you need than absolutely not enough. And I think we are in a situation where in certain districts, the ones that aren't doing so well, and it's not just, and I go back to the conversation I had with my friend who said it's just those people, you know, the Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, it's those people. And I say, no. You look around a lot of the rural areas. Those are school districts that are struggling to make ends meet. Those are districts that are having trouble. And the one thing that I gave Rendell absolute credit for, and I had my problems with Governor Rendell, but the one thing I did give him absolute credit for was his commitment to education. The idea that he was pushing pre-kindergarten. He was pushing full-day kindergarten, you know, because of him. We've got two-thirds of kindergartners going to full-day programs. That's phenomenal. Going from none to two-thirds in just 8 years, that's phenomenal to me. And what we've seen is you've seen a big jump in the number of five-year-olds going to early childhood care programs and education programs. So you got to give them credit for that. And we're really not sure what dividends those are going to pay. But from all indications, most of the studies that I've read, those studies say we're going to save money in the long run because those kids, they're not going to end up in prison. Those kids are going to have the head start. They're going to have that leg up going into school. And maybe they don't drop out. And maybe they finish and go on to college and become taxpayers who make a decent living and fund the programs that they benefited from, like I talk about myself. You know, if it weren't for the Great Society program, some of the intervention programs that were in my neighborhood at the time, maybe my life would have turned a little differently. You know, and a lot of the people that I know who have followed this stuff, maybe things would have gone a little differently. And now, because of a little investment in me, a little helping hand. I now live a very solid middle-class life, and I am a taxpayer who is paying back my debt to society, if you will, and I'm happy to do it. Because that's how this country is going to move forward and be a better place for my children and for your children. And you look at the fact, and going back to what some of the things Rendell has done, you know, I saw Pelleggi say, well, you know, we threw all this money out there, and there's not really much change. The reality is reading and math scores have gone up at every grade level since 2003. So I'm not sure where he's getting that. And the state has been recognized by the Center on Education Policy as the only state in this country, the only state to make significant progress boosting achievement in all subjects and all grade levels. That is a massive, massive undertaking. And we're the only state in the country that's done it. Why? We've done it because we've invested in it. because we decided it was important and times were tough. Rendell could have at any time in those 8 years said, you know what, just to get the budget done on time, we're gonna cut education. But he didn't. And he stood his ground, and that's what I give him credit for. I absolutely give him credit for. Another thing, eighth grade reading scores in 2003, 11 states scored better than we did. Last year, we were second in the nation. Second in the nation. So, I don't know where Pelleggi's getting this stuff, and I don't know where a lot of this hyperbole, a lot of this rhetoric comes from, but the reality is we are moving in the right direction educationally, and we should be staying the course if you want to use a Bush frame, because I think we are doing the right thing. And you know, I see Tony Williams out there pushing this school choice thing, and I see the fact that he took a whole bunch of money during the campaign, during the governor's race to kind of push that out there. Sometimes you got to wonder. You got to wonder what that's all about. But for me, this voucher thing, this is just it's an absolute non-starter, and it's the destruction of public education. It is the absolute destruction of the pathway to the middle class. I can't be any more clear on that. I just absolutely believe this is the death of the working class.
I can tell you why the Republicans are telling you that Rendell spend too much. You call him Spendell, but here's the dark secret that most people don't remember. The previous governor, he was in from 94 to 02, Rich, each year he reduced each and every year's budget money designated for education. Rendell came in, had a huge hole. So that's why only the last couple years of his administration did the test results really bear fruit, because we dug ourselves a hole because the priorities weren't there in the Ridge administration. And how often have I seen that? I've seen that time and time and time again, where Republicans like to get elected by saying, I cut taxes and I held costs. But in fact, they didn't fund the programs that they should. Along comes a Democrat, in this case, Governor Rendell, and he did the right thing, and he did a great job on education. Got to give the man credit.
Yeah, well, so that's where we're going to leave it there. I'm waiting to see where all this flushes out. I'm waiting to see where this goes. I've got to be honest, part of me thinks it's a done deal, and we're going to see a massive windfall for the very wealthy, the people who are already sending their kids to private school. You know, it's a little paycheck for them after the third year, because as I understand it, not the first year, but the third year, they'll be eligible for that. And that, I guess, is the way it's going to go. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Russ Baker. He's editor of the news website whowhatwhy.com, also the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. We talked to him a couple of weeks ago about the book, and pretty interesting stuff. But we're going to talk about what's going on in Egypt, because I got to be honest with you, I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing. I think it can be a good thing. All depends on which direction we take. And I think if Mubarak is out, where do we go from there? It'll be interesting to see. But you see people like John Bolton saying, oh, you know what we need to do? We need to get the Israelis to attack Iran. I'm curious what Russ Baker is going to think about that, because, you know, leave it to a war hawk. Leave it to the neocons to figure out how to turn this into a war scenario so that their profiteers can make more money. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with Russ Baker after this.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. During the blizzard and ice storms that are creating havoc across the country, it's often the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers linemen who are on the front lines making sure that your power stays on, or restoring it when Mother Nature takes it out.
But in Washington, D.C., IBEW Local 1900's John Holt says that an aging infrastructure and a reliance on contractors rather than highly trained full-time employees makes it increasingly difficult to mount an effective response during weather emergencies. He says in D.C. and around the nation, one thing is needed more than anything else to make sure our power grid is well maintained.
If the Public Service Commission would require the companies to hire full-time employees to be able to maintain the system, build the system, maintain the system, and in turn respond in emergency situations, that is ideal, and that's the way it was originally set up, but it's just not working the same way. We really need more boots on the ground that are experienced and that are full-time employees.
The heavy storms have forced at least 33 U.S. auto factories to shut down temporarily. 26 of those were Ford and Chrysler plants. Parts shortages caused by the stormy weather forced the shutdowns of at least one shift at the plants on Wednesday. U.S. auto parts supplier facilities are concentrated in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and those states were hit hard by the blizzard and by ice storms. California's governor is calling on the people of the state to approve a proposition raising taxes to get more revenue for schools. Jesse Russell reports.
In his State of the State address on Monday night, California Governor Jerry Brown acknowledged that education has been one of the hardest hit over the last few years when it comes to making cuts to balancing the budget. During the last 3 years, California schools and colleges have been hit with $18 billion in cuts. It is now up to California voters to approve an extension of taxes under Proposition 98, or education could lose an additional $2 billion. Brown called for approval of the proposition during his speech, and during a conference call on Tuesday, California School Employees Association legislative advocate Steve Henderson echoed the importance of preserving the extension.
For a state that has the highest standards, the highest educational standards in the nation, for us to only be funding our educational program at 56 cents on the dollar, there's something wrong with that.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull down the good old union as coming here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Well, you know that age-old question. I guess that's being played out in Egypt today. Boston.com reported today that since Mubarak came into power in 1981, U.S. taxpayers have spent more than $60 billion in aid to the Egyptian government. More than half of that was spent on weapons for the military, an arrangement that critics say has benefited the American military contractors, that military-industrial complex, more than the Egyptians. Major contracts went to GE Aviation and Raytheon, amongst other firms. No, I guess no surprise right there. What's going on over there? Interesting scenario. I want to talk a little bit about that with Russ Baker. He's editor of the news website whowhatwhy.com and author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Russ, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure.
When you look at what's going on over there, what pops into your head?
Well, first of all, I love what you just said about the defense contractors, and it's so interesting to me how that kind of perspective is almost never offered on our TV screen. These tremendous economic interests that inform the policy everywhere are simply invisible, and so what you have is just a bunch of people who are mad, young people, and isn't it cool that they can use Twitter and fight back and so forth, but there's no context. And it's very interesting to me that even the people that they bring on these shows, the so-called experts, they almost never talk about that. And really, what else is there? I mean, what do you really have in play there? I mean, you've got a very large population, tremendous overcrowding in the cities along the Nile, and really, you know, much of Egypt is empty because it's just hard to inhabit. And so you have these tremendous slums, tremendous poverty. You've got issues of education and, of course, huge unemployment. And you've got a small elite that runs everything. I think what really one of the things that struck me, Rick, this week was thinking about, you know, could we ever have those kind of demonstrations in the United States?
That's what I've been saying all week.
You know, the reason I was thinking about that is, I mean, what's so interesting about when you compare, let's say, a place like Egypt and the United States, obviously tremendous differences in many respects, but the similarity is that in Egypt, a relatively small number of wealthy people really dominate the country, and in the United States, a relatively small number of wealthy people dominate the country. We just live at a higher standard of living for a whole variety of historical reasons.
For now.
Including the fact that we've been able to take many of the resources from places like Egypt.
You know, and you know, I guess the first thing I say is for now, we're better off as we see the wealth leave this country and set up shop in places like China and India to do their manufacturing. I see us going further down that rabbit hole, if you will. But when I look at this scenario, I've come to the same conclusion, I think. What would happen in this country if 2% of the people, because that's what we're being told, about 2% of the folks in Cairo there are coming out into the streets. What would happen if 2% of the people in this country said, we want better jobs, we want health care, we want education, all of the things that, food, that these folks are fighting for?
A good point. And what's very interesting there is I'm not sure, by the way, that we're seeing in Egypt, I don't see good explanations of really who is out there. I mean, it clearly is young people, it's clearly students, and there are others, but these are in the vanguard. In the United States, I mean, you don't see workers really asserting their own interests, and you don't see it there either. You know, that's an interesting question. What would it take for people in this country to get off their dust and to do something and to protect what they have while they still have it? I have to agree with you. I think things are changing fast in this country for the worst. And, you know, ultimately, of course, these giant corporations that have no loyalties, and you know, here's Obama with his, you know, his new commission, and he puts in these people like the guy from GE, despite the fact that GE is not the company it used to be, got rid of a lot of the jobs here and is largely in the credit card and finance business. So these are all going through my head. Now, as far as Egypt goes, you know, we've seen a lot of talk about the Muslim Brotherhood. If you watch Glenn Beck, for example, he's talking about what a great threat they are. You know, I've been sort of watching the Muslim Brotherhood for years, and they don't seem to be particularly effective in Egypt. A lot of people there, I mean, they are Muslim, but they're, you know, how much does that dominate their lives? And even if it does dominate their lives, do they necessarily go for that particular group that has been largely ineffectual over the years since they were founded back, what, in the 1920s, I guess. So I think that that concern, that automatic concern that this is a domino, that it's going to go the same way that Iran went, I don't think you could necessarily say that at all.
Yeah, and what I find interesting watching is the right in the country, in this country, caught between wanting to celebrate this moment as a validation of the Bush doctrine and to use this as a scare tactic to scare the hell out of the American people.
Well, that's right. They're trying to have it both ways. You know, they are. I mean, so Beck did this sort of fascinating thing to watch, this very long presentation of all these, you know, charts and things, and he was showing country after country and saying these are all in flames, and you know what a threat this is. But you know, it's much more complex than that. And one of the complexities, of course, is the relationship with Israel. And on our website, as you mentioned, whowhatwhy.com, where we do reporting and analysis. I noticed that an article by a progressive rabbi, Michael Lerner, in the United States, he had written something about how many Jews, this is not being widely reported, that overall Jews in this country, and I think Jews everywhere, are very, very sympathetic with the Egyptian people, even though there is this animosity over Israel itself. And what's interesting is you don't see Lerner's piece being reported widely. You know where it appeared? On the website of Al Jazeera.
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
Isn't that fascinating?
That is fascinating, because all I keep seeing is John Bolton's face everywhere saying if Mubarak falls, Israel only has days to attack Iran.
Well, you know something? This is very complex, and obviously one of the reasons the United States has pumped those billions of dollars into Egypt is because there's this strategy of it as a stabilizing force. And, you know, that does make sense in a kind of a macro way, but on a practical level, as these populations have evolved and grown increasingly complex, the failure to try and do something there. I mean, they really can't. You see, this is the problem with Mubarak. It's the same problem with the House of Saud. You know, they don't seem to be able to get them to start easing into some kind of transitional situation. And with Egypt, of course, finally now, and maybe this is one of the strengths of Obama, probably more Obama than Hillary Clinton, who I think it tends to be more hawkish on these things, is that they do recognize that there are a lot of different institutions that within the military, within any element, there are all different kinds of people, and you can start getting some sort of a combination and start moving towards some different system. You definitely cannot have elections tomorrow. I mean, there's no way that they're set up with the right kind of institutions for that, but they could start moving towards it. Now, with a place like Saudi Arabia, I don't know how you do that, because, see, the real problem in these places with Mubarak, but even more with Saudi Arabia, is if people got their hands on those folks, they would just lynch them.
Right. Well, I absolutely agree. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Russ Baker, editor of the news website whowhatwhy.com, also author of the book Family Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the hidden history of the last 50 years. You know, I look at what's going on over there, and even if we're told the best outcome comes about, I still remember a conversation I had with John Perkins, a guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he said, you know, you would get somebody who would come into power, no matter how they came into power, and he said, I would walk into their office with a briefcase of money or a bullet, and I would say, you choose. And, you know, I think the big interests that we have in those countries, they don't lose. I'm a little pessimistic of the future for this.
Well, yeah, and what you've got to do is you've got to look at the sort of what we might call the Bush military complex. I think lay out in great detail in my book Family of Secrets is you go back and you look at these outfits like Halliburton, and what have you, and they really have their tentacles into all of these countries. I mean, they built the infrastructure. Bechtel is another one. And these guys went in and out of the various, say, for example, Bush administrations. People like George Shultz went in and out. Then they would go to Bechtel, you know, then they'd come back, then they'd be on a commission. Outfits like Jim Baker's law firm. I mean, they're doing business with all of these guys, you know, and it's absolutely woven into the fabric of the whole situation. So these people in the streets are not just overthrowing Mubarak. I mean, and this is the other problem. In a way, you almost have to feel bad for the guy, because it is true that he was absolutely serving these interests of these people who more or less told him what to do. And so, you know, the United States always plays this act, you know, always, you know, expounding these democratic and values and talking about liberty, and then you know, behind the scenes having to do business with these guys and basically, as I was saying, sort of telling them what to do and what not to do. And it's a complicated game of chess. I don't know an easy solution to it, but it all comes down to if people have a better economic situation, if they have a better education, if they have more of a voice, they do tend to become a more moderate. I mean, that's just an inevitable process.
Yeah, and the question is, how do we get to that point? Because, you know, as I see this moving forward, maybe some things get better there, but over the long haul, I still think, you know, the special interests, or as I hear often, our interests around the globe, they're served first.
Well, they are served first. They're diminishing rapidly, and of course, what we're seeing now with these demonstrations in Yemen, and they just, you know, the reporters can't be everywhere. Otherwise, you'd probably see a lot more already going on in Jordan. I mean, all of those. Wouldn't that be amazing if we saw all of those governments fall in a relatively short span of time? I mean, that would be spectacular, and it would rival what we saw with the Eastern Bloc coming apart as rapidly as it did. And then who knows where that could all go? Of course, with the Eastern Bloc, you quickly saw all these parasitical enterprises going in there and encouraging the, you know, the privatization, the rapid privatization. In places like Egypt, you still have a lot of these state enterprises. So there, you know, there are people who are probably all for what we're seeing in the streets there, because they're thinking, you know what, we can go in there and get a piece of that economy. And so that's another thing I don't see being discussed on TV at all. What about all the banks and these other people who want to go in there and see if they can acquire these things for pennies on the dollar?
Yeah, I'm sure the looting will begin. Let me ask the last question I've got for you. You know, the New York Times just broke the story that that Mubarak's going to be leaving, and they're, you know, they're trying to broker a deal where the vice president takes over. Who allegedly is a, you know, he was the head of the Egypt spy agency and allegedly was a CIA point man. I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I mean, CIA has had people in many of those governments and provided them with significant amount of training and so forth. You know, it's interesting to me that you don't hear this kind of fury from the Egyptians who are being interviewed so far about him. That's different than other countries where, for example, the heads of the Shah's agency, Savak, were, you know, particularly hated. So he apparently has played his cards better. He may be seen as somebody that they can deal with. And you know, there may be some combination there. He may be able to pull it out and work with the military, and then they bring in some of these people. And, you know, I'm impressed with the way that he's managed to sort of, you know, elude that kind of a reputation that so many of them have.
So what role do you think Alberti is going to play in all of this?
It's hard to say. You know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that he's, you know, he's like some of those guys from Iraq, you know, kind of came in late in the game, wanted to get back into the action, and were not really welcomed as somebody who'd been in the country, you know, fighting the hard fight. He's an intelligent man. He played an interesting role, obviously, with the weapons inspections. You know, I wouldn't rule him out. I mean, I think he could play a role in something. What's interesting to me is how few leaders there seem to be in these protests, in the opposition. I mean, that whole thing has been so effectively neutered. There just aren't any obvious names. And because of that, anything or everything could happen.
All right. Who, what, why? What is that?
That is our website. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative reporting and analysis website. We're entirely dependent on contributions from the public, and our goal is to get out stories that you don't see anywhere else.
All right. WhoWhatWhy.com. We'll link that at TheRickSmithShow.com so people can go right there. Russ Baker, I appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Media tycoon Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal last year, and in short order, he has turned it into a tongue-clucking sympathizer with and proselytizer for the biggest of big businesses, not only on its editorial pages, but also in its news stories. For example, a recent report on the economic trouble of America's financial giants was so saccharinely sympathetic to the bankers that you could practically see teardrops on the page. The opening paragraph wailed that the banking industry is, quote, racked by the financial crisis and facing slower revenue growth. Nowhere in the story was there even an allusion to the crucial fact that the racking was brought upon the poor bankers, not to mention the rest of us, by, guess who? The bankers themselves. Instead, the Journal wrote admiringly of Wells Fargo, American Express, State Street, and other powerhouses of finance that are nobly struggling, quote, in challenging economic conditions to cut costs and become more efficient. Would this admirable drive for efficiency include any sacrifices in salary, perks, and bonuses of the absurdly pampered top bankers? Holy Gordon Gecko, get real! No, no, sacrifices for others. As the title of the Journal's article puts it, lenders see little choice, layoffs. And Murdoch's Wall Street Journal is not about to be so rude as to mention that if his banker chums really want to become leaner, they could start by looking in the mirror. Indeed, in deference to the tender sensibilities of Wall Street, the Journal doesn't even refer to the offing of thousands of bank workers as firings. Rather, these people are soullessly termed headcount reductions. This is Jim Hightower saying, in word and in tone, Rupert Murdoch is boiling the journalism out of the once proud news pages of the Journal, reducing the paper's proper name to Wall Street's Journal. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I break in the rocks in the hot sun. I cross the law and the law won. I cross the law and the law won.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our Borowitz report. Andy Borowitz writes, concerned that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak did not receive his message to begin a peaceful transition to democratic reforms. President Barack Obama said today that he would resend the message, but this time in all caps. Mr. Obama said that while he hoped sending the capitalized version of the message would be effective, he said, quote, we have a variety of other options at our disposal, including resending it in bold. In the days since it became clear that Mr. Mubarak did not receive the White House's initial message, Mr. Obama has been huddling with advisors to discuss a range of more drastic options, including changing the message's font altogether. We are preparing to go to a stronger font, if that'll help make our point to Mubarak, said one aide who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Right now, every font is on the table, except Comic Sans. The Republican side, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, said that she would refrain from commenting on the situation in Egypt until she learned how to pronounce Mubarak. Meanwhile, in the National Prayer Breakfast, Speaker of the House John Boehner led all Americans in praying that they never need health care. Our Andy Borowitz report. I love that guy. Funny guy. Anyway, did you see John McCain today? Called this whole thing in Egypt a virus. Said it's a virus that threatens Israel. And you do read these reports, as Russ Baker's talked about, that the Israeli people are pretty supportive of these folks. Again, I go back to this warmongering that the right just seems to be in love with. It's just amazing to me.
Well, if you listen to some of the pundits, I mean, they got the whole Middle East just going up in flames. I don't know if they really secretly want that. I'm not quite sure, but I mean, they're way, 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 way off on that.
Well, you know, here's the thing, and this is what we said about Iran when Iran was having the uprising. These are young people who see the West, which is why I thought it was such a bad idea to go into Iraq. That you have a youth move in these countries that don't want to be part of the old ways, and you know they see the outside world because they have the internet, just like the youth of the Chinese, they see the outside world and they go, you know what? How do I get a little bit of that?
Well, I mean, the truth is, the reformers had the upper hand in the election, much like in this country, you had the mullahs and their political power, and you had the reformers, which tended to be the young, and you had the rest of the Iranians in the middle, and they were in pretty good numbers on the side of the reformers until we got into the region and invaded Iraq, and now you see what we have. All too often we bitterly complain about our plight. Not only in the Middle East, but all over the world, but all too often, what we do puts us in that situation. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy.
The Canadian government is looking to overturn its independent agency's decision to allow internet providers the ability to cap usage. Now, understand, we're talking about this here in this country. And the reason I bring the internet up is you look what happened in Egypt. They basically flipped the kill switch. done, gone. If it weren't for the French, if it weren't for crummy dial-up, nothing would be getting out of there. So, you know, this is kind of what we've got to think about here. And you know, I'm not saying it's ever going to happen here. I'm not saying we're ever going to see the kind of thing that's going on there. But if you, and this is where that libertarian side of me comes out, if you give someone the power to shut off your ability to communicate, you've got a problem. So Canada, who had done this, they had given one company, their big monopoly, Bell Canada, the ability to charge their other customers on the amount of bandwidth they used. So if you had XYZ company who was selling their internet to their customers in an unlimited fashion, but you had a guy who was using more, Bell Canada could charge that small ISP a whole boatload of money and would basically make them uncompetitive. So basically you're creating another monopoly. So there's so the Canadian government saying, look, we've got to go back and look at this because what's going on is Bell Canada has given these people the ability to, you know, like 60 free gigabytes to use on a monthly basis. And once you use that up, you got to pay a buck a gigabyte over that. So there's no more unlimited ISP there. So they're saying, well, you know what? We need to look at that. And I'm kind of saying the same thing. That's why I'm such a big fan of net neutrality. You should be able to use the internet. It should be, and I know there are a couple of different things here, but it should be free and open for everybody to have equal access. And this idea that you're going to give a Comcast the ability to cap seems to me to be a bit short-sighted. Now, understand, Comcast's first victim when they get to do this will be Netflix, because Netflix will die. Because right now they're already doing this. They've told Netflix, we're going to charge you triple the rate we used to, even though we had an agreement. We would use each other's services. Now they've come out and tripled it. And they went to court, and guess who won? Comcast. So as we look at things that are happening abroad, bring it back here and learn the lessons right here at home. That kill switch thing that Trader Joe Lieberman keeps throwing out there, think about that for a little bit. Because it could happen here. I hope not, but it could happen. But you know, you look at what's going on over there, and it's to me, for a while, I'm starting to get this Twitter thing a little bit. I'm starting to look. I'm 43 years old. I thought the technology passed me. I've got to look into it. This is amazing. I remember reading that story, and we talked about it earlier. Where they said the next uprising were going to be, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all these social networking sites. And I said, maybe. But you're seeing it. And that to me is amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right here. We're going to come back with Dr. Steven Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. Evidently, they've got a new jobs report. And to me, all of the shenanigans that the Republicans are doing, all of this repeal health care and the abortion stuff and all the distractions, because they don't have a clue how to fix the economy. Not an idea in the world. There's nothing rattling around in those empty vessels they call heads. Nothing at all. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. As I said in the last break, we're seeing all of this nonsense on the national level. Repeal health care, go after abortion, all of this ridiculous chest-thumping, sloganeering, campaigning nonsense that the Republicans seem to love to do because they've got nothing else. It just goes to point out that they have no idea how to fix our economy. They have no idea how to govern. They have no idea how to lead us to a better tomorrow. To me, it's about jobs. Jobs, 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 jobs. That's what we should be talking about. That's why I've asked Dr. Steven Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, to come on and talk to us about their report that I guess they're going to be releasing tomorrow, Steve. Is that correct?
That's right, Rick. You guys got a scoop tonight. Yep.
All righty. Tell me, what's going to be in this? We're going to get the exclusive here. What are we looking for?
So we've just got the most the numbers for 2010, right? So now we can look back at what's happened in the last year, what's happened in the last 3 years. We can look further back in time, what's going on with jobs. And we're focused on Pennsylvania, as you know, and there's a lot of claims out there that Pennsylvania it doesn't do well in terms of job growth, and obviously every state, including Pennsylvania, needs a lot more jobs right now.
Yeah, because we're the highest taxed state in the entire country.
Yeah, yeah. But so here are the facts. Right now, last year, Pennsylvania is third nationally in terms of job creation, 66,000 jobs. Right next door to us, what some people are looking at as a model for Pennsylvania to follow, New Jersey.
The next president. Yeah. The next president.
50th.
Well, that's not a very good record.
Last place. Governor Christie's been in office 12 months. They lost more jobs than any other state in the nation, I think 31,000 jobs. So, yeah, I mean, our report is systematic. We look at job growth in different ways. The numbers I just gave you are just kind of the raw job numbers. Obviously, you actually want to correct for the size of the state. You want to take account of how fast the working age population is growing, right? Because the number of jobs you need depends to some extent on how much your working age population is growing. But the bottom line is that even when you look at the numbers different ways, Pennsylvania recently has been doing pretty well, about 10th, even when you do take account of the size of the state and the growth of the working age population. So again, we need to do much better. The country needs to do much better. But basically, relative to other states, and particularly relative to New Jersey, Pennsylvania's doing pretty well. So, I mean, this is an important report in terms of policymakers because, I mean, the basic lessons are pretty simple. Since we're doing reasonably well. We want to be thinking about what have we been doing recently. Maybe we want to keep doing that.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing is, since New Jersey's doing so horribly, maybe we don't want to copy them. Those and are the two bottom lines. Sorry,
so looking at what Governor Christie in New Jersey has done, since he's being, by some, being touted as a presidential possibility, what is he doing that's causing them to be last while we're not?
Well, I mean, a lot of what he's doing is he's cutting state spending. Some of it is laying off public sector workers. Another part of it is simply draconian cuts in state spending. And both of those, both the layoff of state workers and the cuts in other state spending, they have a spin-off effect, right? So the workers that lose their jobs, they're not buying stuff in their community. I think that's the basic story. I mean, we need to take a harder look at it and peel the onion, you know. Look, but I mean, again, he's only been in office 12 months. And, I mean, the basic read, the early read is, this isn't working, frankly. I mean, I think this is the kind of performance where the Christie bubble is probably going to burst quicker than people realize. Folks in New Jersey aren't going to put up with this kind of outcome for very long. I mean, they're going to be thinking twice about right. Turning down federal money to build that tunnel to New York. I mean, what he's doing is clearly impacting tens of thousands of middle-class families. So I think people are going to be, again, taking a second and a harder look at what's going on there and kind of realizing that from a pragmatic point of view, this isn't working.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the federal money for the project there to get into New York. You know, I was watching Republican State Senator Gordner talking about stimulus money that came into the state of Pennsylvania. And his claim was, and maybe you've got a better idea of the accuracy of his claim, but that Pennsylvania was the best state in the country getting that stimulus money into the economy and using it for the things that it was supposed to be used for.
Well, I'd love to see that. I hadn't heard that. Our analysis certainly is that the stimulus absolutely saved our bacon, right? You know, the economy was in free fall 2 years ago. The Bush recession that got handed to President Obama, you know, unemployment was rising, job losses were growing, 30,000 a month in Pennsylvania, in early 2009. So, you know, we certainly know that despite some claims to the contrary, that the Recovery Act was absolutely critical to stabilizing the economy at 8, 9, 10% unemployment. But now I'll be very interested to learn more about Senator Gordner's comment and what lies behind it.
I need to look that up because, you know, I almost can't believe he said it as well, but I will find that audio for you at some point here in the near future. You know, I look at Governor Corbett, our governor here in the state of Pennsylvania, and the reality is that he seems to have this man crush on Governor Christie. I guess that's a little extreme. He's got this idolization, I guess, if you will, of Christie. If he follows the Christie mode, which is to lay off a bunch of state workers, deep, drastic cuts in this next budget process, do you think we will be the next New Jersey, somewhere down near the bottom?
Well, I'm gonna go out on a limb here a little bit, speculate a little. I don't think Governor Corbett is going to be that extreme. I think the early read on some of his appointments and the basic instincts of his administration is that they are more pragmatic. Again, the hardest part, I think, for Governor Corbett and his team is that even if they in fact are pragmatic, they're not zealots, maybe like, you know, Governor Christie seems to be, they've got themselves in a little bit boxed in the corner, right? They said very emphatically multiple times they're not going to raise taxes. They're not going to raise fees. So we've got this big state budget deficit, you know, $3 billion, $4 billion, $5 billion, depending on, you know, who's counting. And so I think the challenge is going to be the cuts are sort of going to be forced on the governor and the legislature unless they're willing to revisit the decision not to, to raise any revenues. We think, the folks who make more than $250,000 just got an extension of their Bush tax cuts federally. So it's hard, but there are ways in Pennsylvania to raise the tax rates of the more affluent. You can slap on a somewhat higher tax rate on capital gains, about the only, you know, profits in the stock market are the only parts of the economy that are doing well now. So capital gains are going to be up again after lagging for a couple of years.
Right.
So again, I think, you know, you could raise the tax rate, on those parts of non-wage income. And you'd be getting the money from folks who can afford to pay, and they'd still be paying less than the top tax rate in virtually all our surrounding states. So again, I think what they need to do is look at what's going on in New Jersey,
learn the lessons and move forward.
Yeah, and then say, hey, again, the population of Pennsylvania is pragmatic, as our politicians at least sometimes are, and so I think if the new administration were to say that, listen, now that we're in here, there's no way to balance the books just with cuts, and we're going to do some targeted tax increases on the more affluent, on the extraction of natural gas, on smokeless tobacco. We're going to close some corporate loopholes, right? And then we're going to use that money to maintain that educational funding that has Pennsylvania climbing up the state ranks in terms of educational outcomes, test scores, climbing up the ranks as we're talking about today in terms of job growth. I think the people of Pennsylvania would embrace that kind of reevaluation, that kind of pragmatism. So,
and I'm saying that closing the Delaware loophole would not be raising taxes. It's just closing a loophole. So we're going to let Governor Corbett off the hook. He can keep his no tax pledge. Just close the loophole. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. again, that's right. Too many companies are playing games with their accountants and not paying the taxes they should be paying. That's not fair. I'm with you. That's not an increase in taxes. That's enforcing.
And she's doing something smart.
Yeah.
So the report will be released tomorrow. Where can we get a copy of it?
Folks can go on the Keystone website, www.keystoneresearch.org.
And when it gets up, we will put it on our site at thericksmithshow.com. Steve, always great to talk to you. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for the opportunity.
Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, keystoneresearch.org. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME. We make Pennsylvania happy!
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, just like Kristen did. She says, where is legislation to solve America's revenue problem? Why not restore a financial sin tax on Wall Street at, oh, a 0.25% of every computerized transaction? This was done from 1914 to 1966 on buying and selling of stocks. Time for the evildoers to pay the piper, not working people. She writes, Congress lacks guts, courage, and conscience, or they would have done it by now. Where's the justice? And I agree here, Kristen. Where is the justice? Oddly enough, last night I got home from the show and sat down to, you know, to kind of unwind a bit, turned on my favorite TV channel, C-SPAN, and there they were having a discussion on tax policy, and wasn't I up until 3:30 in the morning. But what they were talking about grabbed me by the throat, and because it's been something that I've been advocating for some time, this idea of moving to a VAT tax. A value-added tax. For me, all of the other industrialized countries in the world are doing it. They have this VAT tax, this value-added tax, as a way to secure their borders, and it almost acts like somewhat of a tariff. It levels the playing field trade-wise. So as you add value to products, it's taxed at every stage of the way. You do away with most other taxes. Some of the folks that were talking on this, a couple of college professors, one, this Lawrence Lindsay, a former top economic advisor to George W. Bush, said all roads lead to a VAT. If we want to be competitive, that's where we're going to end up. And there were a number of, you know, all over the political spectrum of speakers who were saying, you know what, this is the way to go. You get rid of the corporate taxes, you get rid of some of the income taxes, the sales taxes, you get rid of all of this stuff, you ball it up into a VAT tax, and you have one easily collectible tax based on consumption, based on production, that is easily collectible, and they're saying fair. Now, my problem, and I do kind of have a problem with it, is that it does disproportionately hit those at the bottom of the economic scale, which, again, you know, if you've been listening to this program, I'm a fan of earned income tax credits. So you know what? I know I can't make the bottom of the economic scale magically make a living wage. I know employers aren't going to be able to do that. I know they're not going to do that. So for those folks at the very bottom, you help them out by giving them, like we do now, an earned income tax credit, because we want to reward work. You want people going to work. You want people being productive, so you have to reward that. So, you know, when I look at this VAT tax, this value-added tax, I see a lot of potential. And it's one of the things that, you know, maybe on both sides of the aisle there's some agreement, because everybody looks at our tax code and says, man, it's screwed up. Now, are there other ways of doing it? Sure. But I think you have to go with, you can't continue along this line of little Band-Aid fixes and, oh, we're going to extend the Bush tax cuts for another year. Oh, we're going to do this for two more years. Oh, we're going to do this. That hodgepodgery is not going to be successful. Much like our health care policy, much like our energy policy, much like a lot of our policies. Every year, every 6 months, things are changing back and forth. We need some consistency. And I'm in favor, like I said, of this VAT tax. I think there are some other ideas that are not bad, which do away with all corporate taxes, do away with property taxes, do away with everything, all taxes except for an income tax. And you put that on a sliding scale. The more you make, the more you pay. I'm sorry, Mr. David Tepper, you know, if you make $4 billion a year, in a year, you're going to pay a nice chunk of that in taxes. To me, that seems logical. But again, you know, politically, where are we going to go with this? It's going to be interesting over the next year or so, because I think there's a call for it. I think people want a system that's fair, that's equal, but also that's going to bring the revenue in. And the VAT tax, they're saying, is going to solve some of that. It's going to bring a lot of revenue in, because as we know, like here in Pennsylvania, three quarters of the corporations pay no taxes, pay nothing. Yet they claim we've got the highest tax rate in the country, but three quarters of them pay nothing. And you go across the country, and we talked about a story last night where a good portion of corporations pay very, very little, even though they say we have the highest tax rate in the world. But you got a lot of companies that pay nothing. And some of them pay negative numbers. They get money from us because we subsidize them. Me, I'm a fan of saying no more beggar thy neighbor economic development. Sorry, no more government money. The big checks are gone. And that's one of the things I agree with Tom Corbett on. No more corporate income tax. No more state corporate income tax. Do away with that. Let companies make as much money as they want to make. And when they shovel it off to their shareholders, when they hand out their CEOs big bonuses, it's income. We tax it. That's how we control things. But you've got to pick a plan. You can't do this hodgepodgery. You can't say, okay, we're going to do a little of this. We're going to do a little of that. Oh, hey, we're going to tax capital gains at 15%. But the guy who goes and busts his behind swinging a hammer, we're going to charge you 28%. You can't have that. You got to have consistency. You've got to treat people fairly. And, you know, it's that simple for me, Jake. That simple.
Heard proposals, things like the flat tax. We've heard that.
15, flat tax is a failure.
15, 10 years ago, a fair tax.
Fair.
It's a little bit different along the same lines. Your proposals, whether you're VAT tax or just basically an income tax, two things you got to have. And you hit on one, fairness. But you got to prove that there's enough income, too, and no exemptions. And therein lies the problem. I don't care which system you have. You know, Rick, within days, the special interests are going to come before Congress and, oh, my God, we have to have this exemption or the sky's going to fall.
That was the thing.
That's the problem.
That was the thing about the tax reform bill of 86. Everyone said, that, oh, it was a great piece of legislation because it did away with all these loopholes. Did away with the loopholes. Granted, it did away with the loopholes for you and me first. Understand that. You and I, we got hit first. First and foremost, the working people got slapped across the face because now you pay tax on your unemployment benefits. You lost your job, now you're going to still pay tax on unemployment insurance? Are you kidding me? But that's what they put in there, slap in the face. Then you used to be able to deduct all that credit card interest, all that car loan interest, all of that stuff. You could deduct it. You can't do that anymore. Not you, the working person. Corporations, absolutely, but not you. It did close a bunch of corporate loopholes and a bunch of other things, but over the last, 24 years? What have we gotten? Every year, new loopholes. Every year, new loopholes. And they haven't closed any. Every year, new loopholes. So you've got all these special interests, you know, nipping at the heels. And I look at this. Two different ideas that I have. The VAT tax, I think, is probably the more preferable way with a an earned income tax credit for those at the bottom, because the VAT tax is going to help us solve some of our trade problems. It's going to help us maybe even out those trade imbalances, which that to me is, well, that's issue number one in my book. Issue number one has to be, how do we make American companies who stay here, how do we make them competitive? And what I found interesting last night during this discussion that they had is that everyone on that panel, Democrats, Republicans, hated the idea that a company could take a loan here in this country, use that money to build a plant overseas, to move their jobs overseas, and then the American taxpayer subsidizes that company's move because they're subsidizing the loan. They're able to deduct the interest of the loan. So you and I are subsidizing a company moving overseas. To me, again, that's one of those things where basically when someone kicks you in the backside, you turn around and say, "Thank you, sir. Can I have another?" One of those moments. And, you know, while there was differing opinion by the experts, at the end of the day, you have to shut that off. You have to shut that incentive off right away. But here's the thing. If you had this VAT tax, it really wouldn't matter, because you're still paying the value added portion of it at the border. So it acts as a sane tariff and levels the playing field. Because this is how Germany stays ahead of us. This is how they've been able to do very well. Because they make sure that their taxes are collected at the border. They're not stupid. But to me, this is worth looking into, and it'll be interesting to see as we move forward where the decision is on this, Jake.
And isn't it amazing that when you suggest things like that, they say, "Well, you want your tax rates as high as in Europe." Well, it depends how you set that up. If you're investing that added tax back into the economy, like the Germans, and they're very smart, and their standard of living is one of the best in Europe, not to mention healthcare, but that's another subject for another day. What they do, they invest in their infrastructure. They have one of the best highway systems in the world. I know I've talked to you. You said they have a great light rail system.
The metro? Come on. They've got the best public transportation in the world.
They invest back in their country. Now, you know, I don't know that we want to have taxes as high as that, but I think we need
I think it's relative to what you get.
Right. I think we need somewhere in the middle. At the end of the day, we have to invest back in our economy, and those who haven't been paying their fair share have to pay their fair share for our long-term economic viability.
For me, it's relative to what you get. Are you getting your health care? Are you getting old age protection? Are you getting all the things that they get? It's all relative to me. Also, going back to what Kristen wrote, this idea of a quarter of a percent going to every one of those hundreds of millions of computerized trades seems to me good idea. We need to get the power of this country away from Wall Street. We need to stop being at the mercy of the latest, greatest, newfangled financial instrument. We need, you know, derivatives almost brought this country to its knees. Why? Because you had greedy people who were following their own special interests at the expense of the rest of us. And now we're seeing reports that J.P. Morgan knew what Bernie Madoff was doing, decided to do nothing about it. Why? Because it was in their best interest to shut up. I look at this stuff and I go, folks, you got to have somebody in the room, an adult, somebody to oversee this stuff.
And the quandary is this: the very people who are benefiting greatly from the system, and let's be honest, they are, we're going to be asking them to change the system, and that's not going to be easy. You need, and here's where I agree with the Tea Party. Here's where I agree with the Tea Party. We need absolutely a lot of changes in the way Congress is run.
We're right back after this.
Proud
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. During the blizzard and ice storms that are creating havoc across the country, it's often the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers linemen who are on the front lines making sure that your power stays on, or restoring it when Mother Nature takes it out. But in Washington, D.C., IBEW Local 1900's John Holt says that an aging infrastructure and a reliance on contractors rather than highly trained full-time employees makes it increasingly difficult to mount an effective response during weather emergencies. He says in D.C. and around the nation, one thing is needed more than anything else to make sure our power grid is well maintained.
The Public Service Commission would require the companies to hire full-time employees to be able to maintain the system, build the system, maintain the system, and in turn respond in emergency situations. That is ideal, and that's the way it was originally set up, but it's just not working the same way. We really need more boots on the ground that are experienced and that are full-time employees.
The heavy winter storms have forced at least 33 U.S. auto factories to shut down temporarily. 26 of those were Ford and Chrysler plants. Parts shortages caused by the stormy weather forced the shutdowns of at least one shift at the plants on Wednesday. U.S. auto parts supplier facilities are concentrated in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and those states were hit hard by the blizzard and by ice storms. California's governor is calling on the people of the state to approve a proposition raising taxes to get more revenue for schools. Jesse Russell reports.
In his State of the State address on Monday night, California Governor Jerry Brown acknowledged that education has been one of the hardest hit over the last few years when it comes to making cuts to balancing the budget. During the last 3 years, California schools and colleges have been hit with $18 billion in cuts. It is now up to California voters to approve an extension of taxes under Proposition 98, or education could lose an additional $2 billion. Brown called for approval of the proposition during his speech, and during a conference call on Tuesday, California School Employees Association legislative advocate Steve Henderson echoed the importance of preserving the extension.
For a state that has the highest standards, the highest educational standards in the nation, for us to only be funding our educational program at 56 cents on the dollar, there's something wrong with that.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, right now is when we got to do a lot of things, and energy being one of them. We've got to think about energy policy. Where do we go from here? How do we get off the juice? President Obama was in State College today at Penn State University, where he proposed exactly what I've been talking about for decades. His proposal included a mix of federal incentives to push the investment that we need to improve energy efficiency in commercial buildings. Hopefully, very soon he'll propose the same kind of stuff for people's homes. I would love to put solar panels on my house. We've had that conversation for a while. The president also, he unveiled this new tax credit system, a grant program, and a loan guarantee to encourage businesses to retrofit their building to make them use less power, potentially saving as much as $40 billion a year in energy bills. The president was speaking at the rebuilding. He said, quote, "Making our buildings more energy efficient is one of the fastest, easiest, and cheapest ways to save money, combat pollution, and create jobs." Because all this retrofitting, and this is what they should have been doing for a while. And they did a little bit with their, you know, Cash for Caulkers program. But getting people to retrofit the buildings, rewire them, all really, really cost-effective things. Before his speech, though, the president toured Penn State's energy research labs. As you know, Penn State is a leading consortium of academic institutions, nonprofits, and companies to develop high-tech energy research hubs, one of them being in the Philadelphia Naval Yard. They're talking about $129 million in grant money from the DEP, the Department of Energy. But the president was talking to the students and pandering to people like you, Jake. The president said, we need to be just as proud of what we do in the labs as what your football team does on the field. Study and work as if the fate of the country depends on you, because it does. And the reality is, as you look at the investment that they're putting into research and development at this university, it's the stuff that we need. We need new technology. We need to move away from the dirty old stuff. Mm-hmm. We need the investment.
Well, if we touched on it, I believe, last night, but what they're doing, I think it's pretty innovative. You take the money they're investing at Penn State and three other hubs, and then they take that knowledge and they take it down to Philly and see if they can apply it. And once they kind of iron out the problems with it, then they'll make it available into the economy. I think that's a great idea. It's certainly well worth the investment of tax dollars. It can create tremendous amount of jobs and at the same time make us less dependent on oil. Oh, and a third, very beneficial, can make our environmental cleaner.
And, you know, here's the thing. You know, we keep talking about the free enterprise system. You know, there's a lot of money to be made in this down the road. But we're not seeing for-profit companies taking the lead on this. This is the kind of stuff that needs government investment. It needs a little helping, a little nudge, which is what I think they're doing. And why do we need this? Well, I couldn't believe this when I heard it myself. Today, the Senate Energy and Natural Resource Committee, they were holding a hearing on amazingly energy markets that I found pretty interesting, especially the claims of West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who is the newest member of the committee. And I got to play this clip. I got to play it.
What I don't understand is that, you know, all the energies you're talking about, the subsidies, and I think that's what the senator from Colorado was talking about, the subsidies of energy, whether it be to oil, gas, wind, solar, biofuels, ethanol. The only energy source which is the greatest source that we have as far as we're dependent on right now is coal. It doesn't get a penny of subsidies.
Did you hear that? Coal doesn't get a penny of subsidies, he claims. But the reality, again, he can say that, but the reality is the coal industry is heavily subsidized. They get billions of dollars every year in subsidies, not to mention the fact that the coal industry enjoys the freedom to admit pollution that kills and poisons tens of thousands of Americans every year. It destroys our land, our water, and it destabilizes our climate. But you go and you go, no subsidies at all? Wonkerum came up with $17 billion in coal subsidies over the years 2002 to 2006. $17 billion with a B. So when Manchin says, oh, we don't take any subsidies, coal doesn't get any subsidies, you got to figure something's going on here. He goes on to say this, and another one of these, really, really, this is a senator?
But it's been villainized by this administration and so many people, and it's the one we depend on the most. It gives back more than what it takes. I can't figure it out.
It gives back more than it takes. There's a community up north of here, still on fire underneath it, completely useless.
Centralia.
You look at the slurry pits in Tennessee and in Kentucky and in West Virginia that are basically disasters waiting to happen. There's one community where they're saying that this slurry pit, this massive dammed off pit of waste and just horrible sludge is leaking at the foot. And they say when it goes, 3,000 people are going to be killed. Not if, when. So this ridiculous notion that somehow, you know, coal, we don't subsidize a bit, and we get more from it than it gets from us. Nonsense. And this ridiculous notion that this clean coal stuff, you know, maybe clean coal will create jobs. I can see it right now. Let's hold on. The vision is coming to me. Oh yeah. Yeah. The jobs of all those people sitting on stools with little rags and dish soap, washing the coal. So the coal is clean. Yes, I can see that. That's what they're talking about, right? Washing the coal, making the coal nice and shiny and sparkly clean so there's no dirt on it. Isn't that what they're talking about?
Well, they always say clean coal, but is there really such a thing?
I'm sorry. They burn the coal. Yeah, they burn it. Explain to me how burning something is clean. Not getting it.
Well, they do claim that there is such a thing as
reduced.
Clean. Well, they call it clean, but really, truly, strict definition, there is no such thing.
You look at the $1 billion that we put into the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund for all of those people who, they're going to die. And they're going to die horrible, miserable deaths. We've put over $6.5 billion into this over a six-year period from 2002 to 2008 to help pay for the people who work in these industries because the employers aren't mandated to provide them with respirators. You look at all the money that we've given them, billions and billions of dollars, and this guy's got the audacity to say, no. We don't pay not a dime in subsidy. If you remember in the State of the Union address, the president called for the nation to rapidly deploy to electric cars and trucks, you know, to get us off the juice, you know? And maybe all the kissy-kissy, play nice with big business is starting to pay off for them. And maybe in a little way for us, too. One of the nation's top Republican businessmen, FedEx CEO Frederick W. Smith, talking about current energy habits, said, quote, "We cannot continue down this path. There is, however, a solution that may become economically attractive sooner than most think. Cars and trucks powered by electricity. Electricity is generated by a diverse, domestic, stable, fundamentally scalable portfolio of fuels that is almost entirely free of oil. You know, get us off the juice." He wrote this in a Fortune column. He went on to say that of his 700 aircraft, 70,000 motorized vehicles that his company uses to deliver 7 million packages a day, nearly every single one of those is fueled by oil. He says this dependence comes at a significant cost. He says putting the U.S. military at risk and requiring us to accommodate governments that share neither our values nor our goals. And he goes on to say that, look, we've had these oil spikes that cause recessions, and that petroleum was responsible for 43% of energy-related CO2 emissions in 2009. Now, remember, our friendly CEO, Frederick W. Smith, he was a big, big financial supporter of W., big supporter of John McCain in 2008, doled out big bucks. This is a guy who's now saying, well, you know what? Maybe we need to get off the juice. He is a member of the Electrification Coalition, and right now he's calling on Congress to enact bipartisan electric vehicle deployment policy that last year stalled in the Senate. No big surprise there. He concluded his piece by saying, I'm not someone who tends to advocate increased government involvement in the private sector, but there is no free market for oil. This is not a market issue. It's a national security issue. And, again, it's nice to hear him say something like that, Jake.
It's a little bit late, but better late than never.
Welcome to the party. But, you know, reason he's saying this.
Like self-interest.
Exactly, because they're pushing a bill forward right now to electrify the post offices, all of the post office vehicles. So, you know, he's setting himself up. Come on. He's setting himself up to say, well, you know, if you're doing it for the post office, you got to do it for me.
Isn't it amazing when it affects you? You just zero in like a laser. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And, you know, last year when we went to the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, which we're going to attend next week and do our program from live from there, I ran into a guy and had lunch with a guy from UPS. He was one of the big wigs there, and he was showing off their electric package car. And he was saying, you know, and it had, and I think I still have his card somewhere, but he was saying that they intend to move to more electric vehicles because they do a lot of short trips. Now, it's not viable in rural areas where the UPS guy is driving or the FedEx guy or the post office guy is driving, you know, hundreds of miles. But in city traffic, it's perfectly viable. And it saves fuel, and it's going to help get us off the juice. Duh. Seems like common sense. I question, why haven't we done it sooner? Why, instead of saying to the auto industry, here, have a whole bunch of money, why didn't we say, build those and we'll buy them? Again, back to what I've been talking about from the beginning. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Media tycoon Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal last year, and in short order, he has turned it into a tongue-clucking sympathizer with and proselytizer for the biggest of big businesses, not only on its editorial pages, but also in its news stories. For example, a recent report on the economic trouble of America's financial giants was so saccharinely sympathetic to the bankers that you could practically see teardrops on the page. The opening paragraph wailed that the banking industry is, quote, racked by the financial crisis and facing slower revenue growth. Nowhere in the story was there even an allusion to the crucial fact that the racking was brought upon the poor bankers, not to mention the rest of us, by, guess who? The bankers themselves. Instead, the Journal wrote admiringly of Wells Fargo, American Express, State Street, and other powerhouses of finance that are nobly struggling, quote, in challenging economic conditions to cut costs and become more efficient. Would this admirable drive for efficiency include any sacrifices in salary, perks, and bonuses of the absurdly pampered top bankers? Holy Gordon Gecko, get real! No, sacrifices for others. As the title of the Journal's article puts it, lenders see little choice, layoffs. And Murdoch's Wall Street Journal is not about to be so rude as to mention that if his banker chums really want to become leaner, they could start by looking in the mirror. Indeed, in deference to the tender sensibilities of Wall Street, the Journal doesn't even refer to the offing of thousands of bank workers as firings. Rather, these people are soullessly termed headcount reductions. This is Jim Hightower saying, in word and in tone, Rupert Murdoch is boiling the journalism out of the once proud news pages of the Journal, reducing the paper's proper name to Wall Street's Journal.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Smile and breathe as the change all around. Make a mighty tar and pray. Just like yesterday. Then I get on my knees.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails, and sometimes we use them on the program here. Our friends at the Alliance for American Manufacturing have come up with an interesting take on the Super Bowl. Their post, America's Blue Collar Super Bowl, presenting the first ever Super Bowl Manufacturing Index. This year's Super Bowl presents a special matchup. Two teams named for the local industries that are supported by their diehard fans. The Steelers emerged from Pittsburgh steelmaking foundries, while the Packers honored their sturdy meatpacking industry. Both teams are understandably proud of their hometown fans and, of course, the work they do. We're talking about blue-collar folks here, people who get their hands dirty, people who work their behinds off. Both Green Bay and Pittsburgh, they write, are built on manufacturing and are respective epicenters of paper and meatpacking and, of course, the steel industry in this country. Both cities have suffered heavy manufacturing losses, but some paper production remains in Green Bay, and Pittsburgh still retains a steel presence. Both Green Bay and Pittsburgh also enjoy loyal following built on middle-class, blue-collar jobs supported by these industries. And they go back through all of those, through a bunch of Super Bowls, like the first one, 1967, the Packers and the Chiefs. The Packers won 35-10. There were 17.9 million manufacturing jobs in this country. In 1979, when the Steelers beat the Cowboys, there were 19.4 million manufacturing jobs in the country. Last year, 2010, when New Orleans beat Indianapolis, only 11.6 million. And this year, as the Steelers take on the Green Bay Packers, 11.7 million manufacturing jobs. And you look at the reality of, back in 1967, we didn't have the population we have now, maybe about half. And to have that many manufacturing jobs back then, tells a story that we were producing things. Now, the right will tell you, well, what we've done is we've mechanized. We've used technology. So we've got technology doing all these jobs. And I'll buy into some of that. But not twice as much. Because I think we've got double the population now. And to only have 11.7 million manufacturing jobs, tells me we've got some problems. And big problems they are. And it comes back down to policy. It comes down to who we put into office and the things that we do. And Green Bay, I thought it was hysterical that, Paul Ryan's from Wisconsin. And Blue America has a new Super Bowl ad that I just have to play for you because it's poignant. And, being the season, let's take a listen.
People before profits. On Sunday, everyone will be rooting for the Packers, except Congressman Paul Ryan. See, the PAC is community-owned and run to benefit the people, not some greedy owner. Beer is affordable, profits go back into the team, and no billionaire is going to lock out the PAC. But Congressman Paul Ryan doesn't like putting people before profits. Take health care. The Affordable Health Care Act makes health care more affordable for all Americans. It cuts $200 billion from the debt. It doesn't hurt companies, but puts people before profits. Paul Ryan led the charge to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He wants insurance companies running the show. It's like Paul Ryan prefers greedy NFL owners over the Green Bay system. Coach Lombardi said, people who work together will win against any challenger, whether a tough defense or modern society problems. Congressman Ryan, take a page from the Packers playbook. Put people before profits. Support the Affordable Care Act and root for the PAC. Paid for by Blue America and Americans for America PAC.
That's a good ad, and the truth of the matter is you look at this, this repeal gimmick that they've come up with, and, it tells a story, that, the Republicans are on the side of big business. They're not on the side of the people on this issue. And I think it's kind of interesting on how they kind of played that off, because one of the things I love about the Packers is that it's owned by the city. One of the things that I love about it is it's communally owned. Like they said, the beer's reasonable, prices are reasonable. Why? Because the people own it, and they wouldn't stand for it. And they support their team. And, I think a great franchise. An absolute great franchise. So, the question I then have, and if you look at what's going on in Congress right now, if they want to repeal this health care bill. Explain to me why all of the Republicans who promised to repeal this bill have, because you remember what they said. It's a monstrosity, it's socialism, it's all these horrible things. But nearly every Republican lawmaker eagerly accepted government health benefits. Not only did they accept it, they gave it to their employees. So I'm kind of interested why all of these tea twizzlers who are, against social medicine, against, the big Obamacare, against government takeover subsidy of health care, why they're taking the $700 a month in taxpayer money to pay for their health care and to pay for their employees' health care. Why aren't they saying, hey, guys, you know what? We work for the government, and we're doing it out of the goodness of our heart. So we're not gonna give you health care. So we can be like the rest of the nation. Why aren't we seeing that? Well, I think we know why, because they're hypocrites. And it's always one of those things, we're going to take something from somebody else. And that's what I love about this whole stunt, this whole charade, is that it's all about taking from you and me, but it's okay for them to have it. Isn't that beautiful?
It's a pretty good plan if you look at what they offer them, according to, that same report you're talking about. The plan that most members of Congress take, guess what? There's no coverage limit. $20 for a doctor's visit, $10 for generic drugs, free immunization. And like you said, they cover about taxpayers are covering about $700 a month. Oh, and if you remember, the one freshman congressman who was from the Tea Party who voted no, he was adamant because, what was his complaint? He didn't get it soon enough. Remember that young guy?
Oh, the guy, the doctor who said, I have never had a job where health care didn't start on the first day. That, I mean, you want to talk about disconnected.
I mean,
you want to talk about lost.
Brass kahunas.
Let me ask you, how many jobs have you ever had? How many jobs have you ever had where on the first day they said, oh, here's your health care? I've never had one of those. In fact, every job I've ever had, you had to pay into it for a quarter before it became you were eligible for it. So this guy walking into Congress on day one angry that his health care didn't take effect is amazing.
He had to go for maybe about a month without health care. Well, welcome to America, Congressman. How would you like to have no health care at all for 12 months of the year and have a family?
But he's the Tea Party guy.
I'm special.
He's got his thumb on the heartbeat of America. Isn't that what they were telling us?
I'm special.
Are you?
According to him.
Yeah, don't do that again.
You don't like that voice?
No.
Oh, okay. I'll have to work on that, right?
No, but at the end of this, it does seem to me a bit hypocritical that they're going to take the health care for themselves and not extend it to everybody else. What I found interesting today, and again, this is one of those things where you go, maybe something went in the right direction. Senate, as they failed to repeal the health care law, 5147, they did do something that I think is right. They repealed a provision of the health care bill, and it's that tax provision, where you have to give out 1099s for everything over $600. That's a bit difficult. That's a bit excessive. That bill passed. That repeal in the Senate passed 87-11.
And there's an area where the Republicans are already doing it. You just mentioned it. And there's the area where Obama said, hey, look, there are some administrative areas where we can work together. Refine the system, make it a little more responsive. But, you talked about Republicans' obstructionism and their hypocrisy. You covered earlier, Rick, the visit of the president. And by the way, that was at Rec Hall, by the way.
I did say that.
I think you said the Rec Building. But
I said Rec.
It is Rec Hall. But anyway, that's where they used to play basketball. Now they have the wrestling tournaments. Anyway, leave it to the Republicans. I don't know if you know who Rob Gleason is. He's chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party. And listen to what he said. And this shouldn't surprise anybody. In a morning news conference, Gleason questioned whether Obama's energy policy could be trusted and criticized what he called the administration's runaway spending and hostile position towards industry. Leave it to a man like Gleason to criticize a president for trying to make us, energy efficient and create jobs at the same time and maybe, just maybe, prevent thousands of Americans dying in foreign oil, foreign soil, trying to protect our energy sources. I mean, the Republican Party, you think, if he can't say anything good, he'd shut up. But they just continually, whatever this president does, no matter how good, they're there to say no, no, no. I mean, when does this end? Now I knew Gleason, and he's really a hard conservative, but you would think some common sense and welfare for the nation would set in. Here's a man criticizing the president for doing exactly what he should be doing.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Your proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com if you missed any portion of the program. The podcast is there for your entertainment, for your enjoyment, and for you to take a look at. If you've got any comments, we love to hear that. We love criticism. We love all of that stuff. Engulfed by criticisms from women's advocates, the House Republicans have reportedly given up on the language that would deny some rape victims the ability to seek federally assisted abortion coverage. As we talked about the other night with Ms. Friedman, the Republicans were trying to change the language, to change it into something called changing rape into forcible rape under the definition of the law, which means that only a very small portion of women who were raped could actually claim it. Because you remember the guy from South Dakota, the guy who was really, really kind of perverted and kind of twisted. This guy here,
a real life description to me would be a rape victim. Brutally raped, savaged. The girl was a virgin. She was religious. She planned on saving her virginity until she was married. She was brutalized and raped, sodomized, as bad as you can possibly make it, and is impregnated. I mean, that girl could be so messed up physically and psychologically that carrying that child could very well threaten her life.
Yeah, you know, just listen to the words roll off his tongue. Like, he'd thought of this for some time. You know, that's the definition that they were going for. And fortunately, there was an uprising, an outcry, whatever you want to use. And they're saying they're gonna move back away from it. They say that they're going to move towards a provision, H.R. 358, the Protect Life Act, sponsored by Joe the Pitts. Down just south of here, to amend the Affordable Care Act in a way that could preclude women from life-threatening situations. They want to, again, make sure that women can't get abortions no matter what. So now they're saying, you know what, even if her life's in danger, we don't care. No money whatsoever. But they want to take some of the language out. And again, you know what this is about? And I've said this before, this is about going after Griswold. They were angry about Roe, but Griswold was worthy where they were at. So when the Obama administration said that they're examining whether the new health care law can be used to require insurance plans to offer contraceptives, the right is going nuts because we can't have contraception for women. We can't have family planning services for women, which is why we're seeing this attack on Planned Parenthood. You know, those nitwits with their video camera went back in and staged their little play again, you know, doing their creative editing like they did with Acorn. Did you see that video? It's an absolute joke. And anybody with half a mind looking at it realizes that they edited this thing to fit their goal. And they want you to believe, like they wanted you to believe in the Acorn video, that they walked in there wearing the stereotypical pimp daddy outfits, and she walked in with a little string daddy, you know, the little hooker outfit. They didn't do any such thing, but they led you to believe that. And they tried to do the same thing with the Planned Parenthood people. And you know what? They got burned. Because as soon as they went into these offices, Planned Parenthood in those areas called the police. And the National wrote a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder saying, hey, we've got these crazy people coming into our place. We don't know what's going on, but they're telling us that they're dealing in underage sex trafficking. So Planned Parenthood's covered. Personally, I think Planned Parenthood should be out screaming. But they're not, and I don't know why. But here's the thing, and we're going to see it here in Pennsylvania, we're going to see it across the country, they're going to try and defund Planned Parenthood like they did with Acorn. They're, you know, following the same MO. And we've got to be smarter. We've got to be much smarter about this. But this idea that the new health care law may have some birth control in it has, you know, crazy people going nuts, and the Catholic Church is raising objections as well.
Does the administration and the Democrats who are pro-choice, how many times do they have to repeat that it's neutral? And it is neutral. This health care reform bill is neutral on the question. But beyond that, I will never, as long as I live, understand if you are truly sincere. And I'm not questioning the sincerity of the pro-life people. I'm really not. But if you're really sincere, wouldn't you want to avoid any situation which puts a pregnant woman in that situation? Wouldn't you rather avert unwanted pregnancies? That's why I don't understand. What's wrong with education? What's wrong with birth control? I'll never understand that.
Yeah, I had this conversation not too long ago when the abortion issue was hot and front and center. And I was, you know, my mother was a single mother. She was 16 when she got pregnant. Abortion was illegal back then. And I told a story the other night that, you know, look, she had known someone who had gone to Kentucky to get an abortion and came back with an infection, and the way my mother told it, the girl passed away. As I told that story to somebody else in the past, they said, well, what if your mother had gone and aborted you? And, you know, I've thought of that over time. And I look back, and this is hard. This is one of those things that are hard to talk about. I look back and see how difficult my mother's life was from the moment that I was born. The fact that we lived in horrible conditions. The fact that she didn't really have the skills to get a job. And understand, the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, not a good time for single women at all, especially single mothers. And, you know, you go back and you look at the fact that her life basically was ruined because I was born. And to be honest, I responded, you know, maybe it would have been the best thing, because maybe in the future she would have had me at a better time and my life would have been better and hers as well. And the guy I was talking to had no idea what to say, because most people would respond, well, you know, I'm grateful. Personally, I look back and I say, you know, I wonder how much my existence caused maybe to her death when I was 13. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, hey, how much of it played into it? And I look back on that, and I question it. I and maybe it would have been the best thing for her, which is why another reason that I'm in favor of having that choice. Because look, at the end of it, do you want a 16-year-old girl to have a child, to bring a child into this world? At the time, you know, she was kicked to the curb because my grandparents were, you know, whatever that dynamic was going on there. So there she was in this situation. Had it not been for public assistance, aid to dependent children back then, who knows what would have happened to us. And I've talked about that in the past, some of the programs that I've benefited from because of the situation. So if you're going to tell me you're anti-abortion, then at least you have to be willing to put those programs forward, the ones that I benefited from, the ones that made me the person I am today, at least, at the very least.
And that's why people like Bob Casey I have such respect for. That Casey family paid a political price, let's be honest, in the National Party. They did. I think their dad would have had a chance to go on beyond governor. I thought he was a great governor. But because at the time, being a right-to-life Democrat wasn't all that popular, he was discriminated against. But my point is this, Bob Casey, when it comes to taking care of the truly needy, and specifically those children once they're born, taking care of their basic needs, you will not find anyone in Congress that is better at that, and I have the deepest respect for them. He's saying, on the one hand, I'm pro-life. Life is precious, and all the pro-life people say that, and I can't disagree with that. But once they're born, I really resent the fact that some of these right people call themselves right to life. They turn around and they support people who, at least politically, don't. Their priorities aren't there to take care of those truly needy children. And if they're precious when they're in the mother's womb, they're certainly precious once they're born. We have every obligation as a society to take care of those needy children.
Yeah, I understand. I understand the pro-life people. I do. Those are the people who are anti-war, anti-death penalty. I get that. I honestly do. But I know too many people who are pro-birth, pro-war, pro-death penalty.
Yes.
And there's nothing about life in that.
There's an inconsistency there, absolutely.
And, you know, but again, back to what I was saying, that from the very beginning, the reality here is this is taking rights away from women incrementally. And you know what, to be honest, I wouldn't mind that being a man. I wouldn't mind having women put in their place. I wouldn't mind them being subservient to me if I didn't have two daughters. Who at some point in the future, because look, you know, as a man, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have women to, you know, to take care of your every need and to be dependent on you? Sure it would. But here's the thing, as the father of two girls, I don't want that future for them. I want them to grow up and do whatever it is that they can do with their talents and their ability allows them to do, and to be dependent on no one. But if they choose to marry and have children and do those things that that women do, I'm all for it. But I want them to have options. I want them to have opportunity. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people come to talk. Sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and robbery. Father, son, let the cameo. Blue dinner, hell is vain. Oh, 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 he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. All of our archives are there for your enjoyment. If you missed any portion of the program or yesterday or last month, it's all there. I'm not like some folks who, like our Limbaugh friends. Good luck finding an archive of anything he has to say. But it's all there for your enjoyment, your entertainment. I got an email during the break from our friend Mr. Stress. He writes, Rick, I was hired by Greyhound in 1971. My insurance kicked in less than a week after what happened? Oh, yeah, Reagan. And, you know, hey, I never pass up a good opportunity to take a shot at Ronnie because he did. He was one of the guys who, you know, led the charge to destroy the working class of this country. You go back to that tax reform bill of 86. Full steam ahead, old Ronnie went, lowering the top marginal tax rate down to 28%. Down to 28% while raising the bottom rate from 5 to 10%. So the people at the bottom, the poor people, they saw their rates go up. The billionaire class, which we didn't have, we really didn't have a billionaire class then, they got their taxes lowered down to 28% from 50%. And guess what happened? Oh yeah, we've got a billionaire class. We've got the Forbes 400 billionaire class. Why? Because of our good friend Ronnie. Handed over all of this wealth, all of the revenue that used to come in, you know, to do things like, I don't know, fund our government, give money to the states to keep services going. Remember that kind of stuff? Build roads, bridges. Remember that? Education. Remember that stuff? Remember when we used to do that? Because if you ask any school board in this state how to fix the public, how to fix the school districts, they all say, have the states give us a bigger share of the money like they used to. Because as the money has stopped flowing from the federal level to the state level, it stopped flowing from the state level to the local level. Which means what? Oh, that's right. You people who pay property taxes like me, our property taxes go up to fund the schools, to fund our local governments. So when Corbett took the no tax pledge, I swear, solemnly swear to never raise taxes, fees, or anything else. When he held his hand up and he said that, that meant your taxes are going up on the local level, your property taxes, your school taxes, going up, up, up. So when he says, I didn't raise taxes, go, yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. But, you know, we don't talk enough about the Reagan years, Jake. We don't talk enough about the destruction of collective bargaining, the destruction of the right of association, that firing of the Patco workers, August 6th, that firing of the Patco workers, that was the shot. Now, granted, you know, and this is where I'm going to say, granted, the Patco workers, they were in violation of their contract. They should have gone back to work when they were, they made their point. But at the end of it, this was that opportunity that Reagan just loved to have, to stick it to the working class.
Maybe I shouldn't even make this comparison. It's a little bit like what Adolf Hitler did with Germany. They kind of, initially at the beginning of World War II, when they went into Sudetenland, they were ready to pull back if anybody would have challenged them. And if the FL-CIO and working people would have went out in a national strike, I guarantee you the businesses of this country would have been calling the White House, hey, end this now. But we didn't have the kahunas, and I blame that on the leadership, I got to tell you. I think if George Meany were alive at that time, would have been in charge at that time, I think things would have been a little bit different. But, you know, Lane Kirkland at the time came from a different world, and unfortunately we didn't challenge him. And it was downhill from then, because you and I both know, Rick, that was a signal. That was a signal. You can go after unions.
And they did, full bore ahead. And now what we're seeing this call by the right to go after after teachers and go after firemen and go after policemen and go after the people who administer the unemployment compensation programs, the folks who work in our government offices. It's open season on them. It's open season on public workers, the people who plow the roads and take care of the parks and do all the work that we don't think about. And I think there needs to be an education campaign of exactly what a public sector worker is. Because we seem to think, and it's this mean that the right keeps putting out, that there's this lazy worker who's just sitting around drinking coffee and having a high old time in that room that has the gold-plated door that says Waste, Fraud, and Abuse Department on it. Doesn't exist. absolutely doesn't exist, but the right keeps throwing that out there.
Well, you touched on something here, and you didn't quite say it, but you touched on it. How many times when people criticize unions did you hear them say, well, they protect the lazy. They protect the lazy. They protect workers who should have lost their job. Well, the truth is that it wasn't too long ago. Within 5-6 years, that the 10 biggest companies in this nation were all union. The truth is unions actually increase, in many ways, increase production by working with the company and by ironing out the problems on the shop floor. I mean, we went over this before, but unions in conjunction with management many times are more efficient than non-union outfits. You mentioned Ronald Reagan. There's another thing you forget. Not forget, but you touched on it. Unequal wage distribution, unequal distribution of wealth. It started in 1980. Here's some quick figures, Rick. Between 79 and 2007, the richest 10% counted for a full 91% the average income growth. 91%. And then we wonder why, when we look at the numbers from 78 until today, in terms of real wages factored in with inflation, they've actually gone down.
Well, it's because, you know, you've got this tax change, and you've got the destruction of people coming together in collective bargaining. Of course, what do you think happens? You've got this falling capital gains rate. You know, at the end of it, you know, we handed all up to the top in the hopes that it would trickle down. Remember, that's what they told us. It's trickle down. You know, if we give everything to the corporate masters, here, we sacrifice our all to you. That they'll take care of us. That it'll rivers of, you know, of honey and gold and wonderful things flow upon us.
I'd like to know what golden rule of conservatism Ronald Reagan was loyal to. Was it fiscal conservatism? No, he left the office with a nice big fat debt. Was it smaller government? No, he actually doubled government. Was it integrity in government? No, he had the most corrupt administration in the history of the country up till then. Until the Bush administration.
Until W.
So, what sacred cow of the right did he bow to every day
money.
And fulfill? That's about right. Well, but I mean, seriously.
At the end of all of this, that's all that matters to them.
But
all the other stuff is just shiny things to keep the sheeple happy, to keep them separated.
But Rick,
that's the end of it.
Here's the problem. The real rank and file who say, oh, I'm a conservative and I love Ronald Reagan. They have this perception that he just changed the country and he saved you and I so many dollars and he reduced government. He just changed the direction of the country. He did for the worst, but it wasn't along conservative lines. But yet they want to build if it was up to the Republicans, they'd put his face on Mount Rushmore. I mean, they changed, what was it? Didn't they want to put Ronald Reagan's name on the airport? Washington, anyway.
No, it's not that they wanted to. They did.
They did. Okay. Okay.
It's Ronald Reagan National Airport.
Okay.
They wanted to replace FDR from the dime and put Reagan on the dime. They wanted to replace Jackson 20 and put Reagan on there. The state of Tennessee went nuts. There's a whole movement to put him all over post offices and schools and every federal building led by Grover Norquist. Grover got a whole bunch of money to run out there and go, you know, we're gonna put Ronald's name everywhere. And we all know what Grover's famous for. Here's the famous clip.
I want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
And they've done that. They've defunded, they've destroyed, they have done everything in their power to destroy our government and us along with it. You look at the stuff that's going on, folks, and until we wake up, and until we stand together and fight back, they're going to continue to win.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Don't
Rick Smith Show on
Time. This has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. The democracy is coming to the USA.
The Rick Smith Show on Gun.